Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
I wrote the book in 1966, and the film was made in 73. And here we are 30 years later, and I think it's every bit as powerful, if not more so, than it was when I first did it. Oh, man, it was an adventure. I enjoyed every minute of it. You know, a lot of people would have shriveled up and blown away. But, man, I was exhilarated. I'd go home and go to bed and wake up vibrating. Because we never knew on Thursday whether we could meet payroll on Friday. We had to shoot it guerrilla style because that was necessary. The shots that we got of Chicago, we stole. We couldn't get the permits from Mayor Daley, the elder. So I said, look, man, we don't need no permits. We take a camera into Chicago. Who's going to come and ask us for some paper? So we went in and we shot one scene on the L platform on 63rd and Cottage Grove, which is in the hood where I grew up and where I still live. How did we shoot it? We paid and went through the turnstile. And then we wanted some shots of the L moving, so we got on the next L that came along and went up to the front and pointed the camera out there and shot that. All the scenes in Chicago were theft. It's guerrilla cinema. Now, I don't see any reason why we should do anything else. If we're going to be outsiders, man, take advantage of being outside. Okay? If you want to be a rich hoe, then go to Hollywood. If you want to say something true about black people, then do what we did. Raise the money from the black community and shoot what you want. Ivan's attorney, Tom Newsom, was a major. He and his brother, who was a professor at Toledo University, were the major fundraisers. For instance, I never raised a dime out of my hometown, Chicago. Tom and Dan, his brother, raised the money. And we put every bit of that money into shooting the film. And we raised about $850,000 from blacks. As I recall, UA put up completion funds, and it was less than $200,000. Black films ought to be about black people. They ought to have the same criteria as white films. Financed by, written by, produced by, directed by, distributed by, in theaters that we own, if possible. I'm talking about an interdependent economy. I say interdependent because it would be impossible to just pull ourselves out of it.
Self-reliance.
What's that?
Self-reliance,
yes. So how do you Which is what my elders preached to me when I was growing up. Now we're talking about integration. Now it's diversity, and the latest thing is reparations, which ain't nothing but begging for crumbs from the white man's table. And we ought to be about the business of building our own tables and baking our own bread. I want people to think. And out of thought, concerned action. You don't act first and then think. You think first and then act. That's why we were given brains. That's why we don't act instinctively. And when we do, we're wrong. Whichever way they go, I want them to think about what I've had to say. I'm not trying to recruit anybody. I'm not trying to proselytize. I'm not trying to convince anybody. I want to shake up the mind. I want people to look at that movie and go out of there thinking. And I think I've accomplished that purpose. And I feel just like the entertainers and musicians that preceded me. I wouldn't give a damn if nobody white ever read my book. If they do, I want them to pay for it and get my royalties. And if they get something out of it, I say, fine. But my audience is not white. I don't write for black bourgeois intellectuals. I write for the people on the block where I live. Well, man, if you don't belong someplace, get the hell out. There's no excuse now for black people not to be making their own films. With modern technology, you can shoot a film that 10 years ago would have cost $10 million for less than a fraction of that. Now, why do they have to go through all of that pain, man? Are they masochistic or what? Are they hoping that one day they'll make a whole lot of money? You can make a film with shoot it DV, digital, for a fraction of what you would. You can make a damn good film for $1 million. In fact, if somebody gave me $1 million, I'd shoot three. If you want to work for white folks, take what they got to give you, put the money in the back and stop whining. And if it's painful, get out. You can't have it both ways. Once upon a time, they used to own slaves. Nowadays, they rent us. You can break the lease if you want to. I did.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, October 21st, 2016. So I have been told. This is our sixth and final study session on Sam Greenlee's The Spook Who Sat by the Door. We are picking things up on Chapter 18. We are already past the rioting in Chicago. They have kidnapped and slipped acid on Colonel Bull Evans. They just returned him where he's declared that he's just met the best bunch of niggers in the world. So we're picking up at the beginning of Chapter 18. Be ready with your final thoughts on the text. Takeaway themes that you will leave the book with, and anything that you want to get in as we wrap things up today. That was, of course, Sam Greenlee that you heard at the beginning of the audio. We will go ahead and get started without further ado. Context of White Supremacy, The Spook Who Sat by the Door, audio segment number one.
Chapter 18. The National Guard unit reacted with predictable ferocity to the humiliation of their commander. Never a well-disciplined unit, they now roamed the streets with their weapons fully loaded, around in the chamber and safeties off, eager for their first kill. The ghetto, with a survival instinct centuries old, faded into their homes, and the guard turned their fury on the very streets where a black mob had roamed only a short time before. All undamaged stores were used for target practice, a handful bombed with grenades under the assumption that they were colored owned. "We're evening things up," said one sergeant. Trigger happy, panicky, smelling the hatred and contempt the ghetto Negroes felt for them, they fired at almost anything that moved, and black casualties mounted. At nightfall, the ghetto hit back, and snipers roamed their turf in search of white targets. Poorly armed with pistols, shotguns, surplus World War II M1 carbines, they proved a poor match for even the ill-trained guard unit, but their effect on the morale of the guard was staggering. Panic increased, and the guards' casualties came mainly from their shooting one another accidentally or in fright. A sniper was rumored to be on the roof or in one of the apartments of a three-story building, and a half truck with four 50-caliber machine guns mounted was rolled to within 50 yards of the building, and the big guns turned on it, pinning the occupants to the glass-strewn floors of their apartments for more than half an hour, killing one mother of four and wounding two others. Freeman risked roaming the streets, gathering intelligence, noting the command posts, the disposition of the units, the state of their morale, their dwindling discipline. "Turk, when do we go into action?" asked Stud Davis. They were gathered in the pool room late that night, Davis, Dean, Scott, and Dubois. "Tonight. First the sniper teams to keep them panicky, then we hit hard in a few days with our attack teams." They leaned toward him in eager anticipation, ready after the long months of training for their baptism of fire. "I want all sniper teams in the field except the reserve. Sugar, you know their sectors of operation, so get the word out. I want the reserve in the field the following night. Then operate from that point on with one-third of the teams at a time, so everyone has two nights of rest in between. Daddy, you work out the rotation. Sugar, you figure out logistics and supply. Willie, get to work on propaganda leaflets to be distributed the day following our first hit." "Turk," interjected Stud.
"Yes, Stud."
"Is it all right if I work solo? I don't mind leading an attack team, but for sniper work, I'd rather work alone." Freeman thought for a minute, then said, "Tell you what, we'll work together the first night. I'll act as your cover, you command. If I dig your action, okay, but either way, the decision is final."
"Okay with me, Turk."
"Right. Willie, you take command of Stud's team. Will that give you time for the leaflets?"
"Yeah, Turk.
I'll set things up, and the cell can handle it from there. They're damn good. In fact, they could function without me."
"That's the scene we want. Nobody indispensable.
Now listen carefully and take notes. Daddy, call the weather station and get the exact time of sundown and sunrise for tomorrow night. I want everyone in a darkened room 1 hour prior to sundown to start on their night vision, and all teams out of the field no later than 1 hour prior to sunrise. I also want wind direction, wind velocity, temperature, and relative humidity transmitted to the teams for calculation for firing. A large breakfast is okay, but a light lunch and no liquids or stimulants of any kind after lunch. No more than one cigarette an hour until H hour. One joint prior to an afternoon nap is all right. We all know the drill. Any questions?"
There were none.
"All right. Synchronize watches by radio or telephone tomorrow night at curfew 2200. H hour is 1 hour later, 2300. Move out." Stud Davis awakened the next morning precisely at 7, the hour he had decided to awaken the night before, without the aid of an alarm. He was alert the moment he opened his eyes. He lived in a single-room kitchenette with small bathroom and shower. It was in the rear of a large kitchenette apartment building and included a back porch overlooking the L tracks. The room was neat and spare. It had a combination gas range and refrigerator, a television set tucked into one corner, two chairs, a card table covered with oilcloth, and a transistor radio seated on a small table near the head of the bed, which doubled as a couch. Stud arose, walked into the bathroom, rubbed his light beard, and decided he did not need a shave. After washing, he returned to the room and slipped into a pair of tight-fitting jeans, which he wore only at home. He put on a percolator and, while awaiting the coffee, ate a large bowl of cornflakes with sliced bananas while listening to his favorite radio station. He drank the coffee, then ate four fried eggs and bacon, washing it down with a half quart of milk. Not until then did he have his first cigarette of the day. He snubbed out the butt, washed the dishes, and tidied the room, a spotless oasis in the smelly, dirty building. He had a thing about cleanliness. He left his apartment and walked the few blocks to the pool room for the final briefing before the night's action. He moved loose and easy, fighting the heavy drowsy feeling he had always felt before an important athletic contest because it was much too early. That afternoon was soon enough, and he would allow it to grow gradually until the release of the first round fired. It had been much the same in each of the sports in which he had excelled. You controlled the feeling and used it, not the other way around. He sat silent through the final briefing, offering no contribution and asking no questions. Freeman asked him to stay after the others had left. "I'll be your cover stud, but the scene is yours tonight. As I said in the briefing just now, we'll be operating as a roving team in Sector 6. Our first target will be the Quad 50. After that, targets of opportunity." Stud smiled tightly. "I saw what that thing did to the building. I never thought a machine gun could do that much damage to bricks and concrete." "It's a bitch of a weapon, and multiplied by 4, you got something else. One of the little girls who is in that building screams constantly every time they take her off tranquilizers. I want that gunner." "I saw him on TV. He looked like he was sorry the building was still standing," said Stud. Freeman pointed to a map of the area. "They're usually stationed here. We'll approach this way and fire from the roof of this building. That way, they'll have to swing the gun mount a full 180 degrees to bring them to bear on our position after they spot us, and by that time, we should have got in our shots and been long gone. We both go after the gunner, and after he's hit, you take targets from 12 to 6 o'clock, and I can take them from 6 to 12. Don't get greedy, and don't wait for them to locate us. When we get in our rounds, we move on. Okay?" Stud nodded. "I don't doubt you can work solo, but I have to check you out this way so the cats don't think you get special treatment." Stud smiled broadly. "I'll see you at the rendezvous tonight." "Easy, Stud." Stud picked up his dismantled weapon and ammunition, one of the .03 sniper rifles with scope. He returned to his apartment, cleaned and oiled it, checked its moving parts and the scope, then wrapped it in a lightly oiled cloth and placed it beneath his bed. He washed away all traces of oil from his hands, carefully cleaning his nails as he did so. He turned on his small television set, found nothing to his liking, then lay on the couch listening to the radio until time to fix lunch. Burkhart had risen to Freeman's bait, and after working on a .22 rifle range several evenings with the gang leaders, all on their best behavior, sirring him until dizzy, he agreed to coach a larger group. It was Stud who sold him, and Burkhart was enthusiastic about his potential as a marksman. "This boy, Davis," he said to Freeman, "is the best natural rifleman I've ever seen. You're sure he's had no previous experience with a rifle?" "I'm certain, Mr. Burkhart," Freeman replied. "Amazing," said Burkhart, watching Stud firing prone on the University 22 range. "Why, he's potential Olympic team caliber. I'm certain he'll be able to do well in the National Junior Championships in less than a year." "If he sticks with it," said Freeman. "He loses interest in anything as soon as he's mastered it. As soon as he really becomes good with a rifle, he probably won't even want to see one."
But Freeman was wrong. Stud Davis had finally found his métier, the one thing which quieted the fear he hid so well. He never saw a bullet at the center of the target, but always a man, any man. In less than 2 months, he was a better marksman with a rifle than Freeman. To Burkhart's chagrin, but not Freeman's surprise, the National Rifle Association refused their application for membership and the club broke up. But 10 of the Cobras had had several months of intensive training on a rifle range. Scott and Dean left the pool room together.
You going home now, Daddy?
Nah, I better check with all the leaders of the sniper teams, make sure everything groovy. Turk said to cool it until tonight.
It's all right. Turk will understand. Cool it.
Scott walked home and spent the afternoon figuring the formulas for the flight trajectory of a 30 caliber bullet for various angles and ranges. Mathematics always relaxed him. Freeman spent the morning at the office, left just before lunch, announcing he would tour the riot area and made a last-minute check of the positions to be attacked. They had not been moved. He returned to his apartment, cooked and ate a light lunch, went to his bedroom, and slept until late evening. He awakened to the first sound of the alarm and dressed in the dark. He met Stud at the appointed rendezvous, both dressed in dark clothing, including low-cut black sneakers, wearing wraparound sunglasses to protect their night vision. The other snipers moved in teams of three, one as decoy, the other two as fire team. The decoy was to shoot from opposite the fire team to draw fire, then disappear. The remaining two would then open fire from behind to catch the guardsmen exposed and firing in the opposite direction. Without a word, Stud and Freeman moved silently over the rooftops and took their position above and beyond the Quad 50s mounted on a half truck, a World War II vehicle, as was most of the guards' equipment, but deadly nevertheless. Stud held up two fingers to indicate a range of 200 yards. Freeman nodded his confirmation. Stud nodded again, and they each slipped their arms through the slings, using the roof parapet as a support, jacked around into the chamber, and slipped off the safety. The gunner was seated on the mount, smoking a cigarette and talking to one of the crew. Freeman placed the crosshairs of the scope on his middle and, at the sound of Stud's shot, squeezed off his own. Both rounds hit and the gunner dropped to the street, dead before he hit. Stud shot him again as he lay in the street. They both emptied their clips at the scattering crew below, reloaded and disappeared as silently and swiftly as they had come. Across the rooftops came the scattered firing of other teams in action. The war had begun. That night, the Freedom Fighters killed 6, wounded 19, and received no casualties. Escalation by both sides could be expected. After 5 nights of sniper activity, Freeman ordered a 2-day rest and then ordered his attack teams into the field. Same scene as with the snipers. All teams into the field the first night, then a 1/3 rotation after that. We don't need any heroes. Hit and run. Hit them when they least expect it, then disappear as soon as they deploy and return your fire. If they follow too aggressively, ambush them. Otherwise, vanish. Stud Davis moved his attack team down the alley through the moonless night. He could hear the big rats scurry into hiding as they approached and return to their feeding as they passed. He had hunted the rats at night in these same alleys, 2 boys leading, one with an air rifle, the other with a flashlight. One would fix the rat with the beam of the light and the other would fire. Unless hit exactly right, the BB would stun but not kill, and the other boys would finish the rat with sticks. It was a good sport, and he had learned that the rats did not fear man. They just got out of your way because it was easier. The rats would often charge the group when cornered if the boy with the air rifle missed. He was leading the maneuver squad of his team, the fire squad, approaching the street which intersected the alley from the opposite block. He halted his men with a hand signal and looked out into the deserted street. It was several hours after curfew and the streets were silent and empty. He checked his watch, then motioned his men into cover at the alley mouthway and behind parked cars at a short distance away. He saw that across the street, the fire squad was already in place. His maneuver squad of five were each armed with a hunting knife, pistol, grenades, three with shotguns, the other two with semi-automatic carbines. The fire team were all equipped with weapons on full automatic. He heard the patrol approach, two jeeps much too close together, containing four men each, the driver, a rifleman, and two tending the mounted machine gun at the rear of the vehicle. Stud waited until they were about 10 yards away, stood, and threw a grenade. Four others followed suit, and they all ducked for cover. The explosions followed quickly upon one another, and the sharp staccato of automatic fire echoed the loud thumps of the grenades. One jeep lay on its side, the other had crashed a parked car. Stud signaled, and the fire ceased. He led his maneuver team cautiously toward the ambushed patrol, their guns at the ready. He turned off the ignition of the jeep in turn and motioned his men to strip the bodies of guns and ammunition. One boy of about 19, Stud's age, moved feebly in a pool of his own blood, shock and surprise on his face. Stud paused to look at his face. He might have played basketball against him. He bent to take his weapon and ammunition. The boy asked over and over, "Why? Why? Why?" Stud bent close so that the boy could hear and said, "Because it's war, Whitey." They finished, and in seconds, the dark of the alley swallowed them up. The rats moved from their burrows, sniffing the strange smells in the air, the bolder and more curious ones moving toward the compelling smell of blood. The rest returned to their feeding, and the occupied ghetto was silent once again. Chapter 19. Colonel Evans had been relieved of his command after his kidnapping, although the newspapers indicated he was recovering from injuries received during his heroic escape from his hoodlum captors. The president, acting on requests from the governor of Illinois and the mayor of Chicago, ordered a brigade of the 82nd Airborne Division airlifted from Fort Bragg, North Carolina, to Chicago to relieve the National Guard unit. Brigadier Scott, commander of the Airborne Brigade, met with Lieutenant Colonel Jensen, acting commander of the National Guard unit of occupation, in the Guard's headquarters for a debriefing session. "Damn it, Colonel," said the brigadier. "You mean military troops can suffer the kind of casualties you've taken from a bunch of unorganized hoodlums?" "It's far worse than that, sir," replied Jensen. "Someone has trained those bastards, and they've been trained well, and they have military weapons, most of them automatic." "How could they get their hands on weapons of that kind?" "It must be the gang who robbed the National Guard armory," said a quietly dressed civilian who had been allowed to attend the debriefing. There was no publicity because the press agreed to a blackout while we investigated. "They have a pretty good arsenal, M14 and 16 rifles and ammo, grenades and launchers, communications equipment, the works. in the crowded slums where they operate and you can't use your heavy weapons, they can match your firepower. The sons of bitches, said the brigadier grimly, and we thought it would be another operation like Detroit last summer. What kind of tactics are they using, Colonel? Hit and run attacks and ambushes. They won't stand and fight. Usually, groups from 5 to 8 operating in tandem, each with a section leader and the entire unit commanded by one man. They demonstrate knowledge of fire and maneuver, small unit tactics, and seem well-disciplined. The commies must be at the bottom of this. Where else could they get that kind of training? You're probably right, General Scott, said the civilian. I'm certain the Russians have smuggled in one or more of their top agitprop agents, and I'm requesting counterinsurgency teams from Washington today. Agitprop? Agitation and propaganda. Experts in the creation of chaos, insurgency, and revolution. They wouldn't dare, said the colonel. That's what we said about the Cuban missiles. The brigadier turned to his adjutant. I want the patrols doubled tonight. Weapons on full automatic, and the orders are to shoot anything moving after curfew. Shoot to kill. The members of Freeman's recruitment and training cells had been organizing and training units in 12 major cities since the first of the year. Freeman considered 9 of the underground units combat ready, the remaining 3 marginal. He ordered operations in Chicago reduced to harassment and ordered his 12 other units into action. He awaited the effects of his escalation of the war. They had left during the bitter cold of early January, the quick-witted hustlers of the gang, those most likely to think, adjust, survive on any ghetto street. They were to submerge themselves in new identities, establish a cover, and recruit, organize, and train those street gangs in their new cities, which were most like the Cobras of Chicago. They left with sealed orders for a temporary destination within a 200-mile radius of Chicago. The orders indicated their new area of operation and contained cash, various documents of identification, and the name of a bank where funds could be drawn under their new names. They moved into the teeming ghettos, their new homes, each a seed of rebellion planted in fertile soil. Freeman had patiently built up an intelligence network, bus and taxi drivers, the drivers of mail trucks, postmen, delivery and messenger boys, anyone who would be able to circulate freely after the riots had begun, garbage men, street cleaners. He recruited 6 medical students, 2 interns, and a young surgeon, plus 8 trained nurses. He was extremely careful in attempting to recruit anyone from the black middle class, but found to his surprise that a growing number shared the attitudes of their less fortunate black brothers. He felt that if the Ku Klux Klan could infiltrate the Chicago police force, there was no reason the Cobras couldn't as well. In a short time, he recruited 6 uniformed policemen and 2 detectives. He still hoped to recruit Dawson as his chief double agent and second in command. He knew that inevitably the cumbersome bureaucratic machinery of the nation's law enforcement agencies would begin their search to destroy him. The general personally accompanied the CIA counterinsurgency teams to Chicago to supervise the setup of their operation. Shortly after arrival, he met with the hand-picked members of the group, codename Operation Law and Order. It will be SOP for this kind of operation. Infiltrate a paid informer. Identify and place on our payroll a defector as a double agent. Divide, confuse, bore from within. Our primary target is their leader, undoubtedly a Soviet professional. Cut off the head and the snake will die. Whoever he is, we should give the man
due professional credit for organizing ignorant slum dwellers into a fighting unit as effective as so far proven. Until we crush this insurgency, we operate around the clock. 3 evenings later, Freeman received a phone call at his apartment. It was a vaguely familiar woman's voice who asked if she could come to his apartment within the hour, but refused her name. She said that it was urgent. By now, Freeman was operating under strict security measures. He assumed that all except public phones chosen at random were bugged. He made standard checks for a tail whenever he went to a rendezvous, which could not be explained by his normal duties with the Foundation. He therefore regarded the mysterious call with suspicion. He took out a Colt Woodsman 22, checked the mechanism, and loaded a clip. He generally mistrusted automatics and never left a clip fully loaded so as not to weaken the spring. He slid the clip into the butt, jacked a round into the chamber, and made sure the safety was on, and sat listening to music while he awaited the arrival of his visitor. A half hour later, the bell rang, and he walked to the door of his apartment, pressed the buzzer to let the visitor in from the outer hall. He checked the door to make sure that no one was already waiting for him, and then cracked it enough to see the elevator. He held the gun at his side, the safety on, but ready to fire. The elevator stopped at his floor and the door opened. She stepped out and looked for the number of his apartment, then approached his door. Freeman slid the Colt behind a bookcase near the door, then opened it wide to greet her. He noticed how well the red dress went with the rich black of her skin. "I'll be damned," he said. "The Dahomey Queen." He opened the door wide as he smiled in greeting and stepped back to let her enter. She walked down the short hallway to the living room, turned in the middle of the room to smile at him shyly. She wore her hair natural, kinky, and the same short length all around her head, no straightening irons, no oil. There were large gold hoop earrings that emphasized the beauty of her slim, long neck. She wore no lipstick, just a touch of makeup to bring out the almond shape of her eyes. "Baby, you're beautiful. Sit down and let me fix you a drink. Johnny Walker, Black Label, isn't it? I'll be right back, and then you'll have to tell me what you've been doing since the last time I saw you and what you're doing here in Chicago." He returned with the drinks, then moved to the stereo. "Let's see if I can remember the jams you dig. So what are you doing here, and how did you find me?" Freeman was on guard because he had never told her his name, and she had never asked it. They hadn't had that kind of arrangement. Then he remembered she did know his name. They had been stopped in Washington one night by a cop, and there had been the usual scene. He had to show Freeman himself, and far more important, Freeman's woman. That Freeman simply did not count as a man. Freeman had endured it until the policeman threatened to search her, and he had intervened, showing him his ID. Until then, she had known him only as Dan, and she had wondered aloud why a District of Columbia cop would call any Negro "Mr. Freeman, sir." "Well, I got to be here in Chicago for a few days, and I thought I'd look you up and say hello. There ain't that many Freemans in the book with your first name, and I got you the third time around. You know, you used to talk about Chicago all the time. Never could figure out if it drug you or you dug the place. Seemed sometime like both scenes. I ain't hustling no more. Got me a sponsor. Turned me on to a down pad out in Northeast D.C., and he sponsors the whole scene. I even save bread out of what he lays on me, and I got a part interest in a bar. When the scene is over, I won't have to hustle no more. Bought a little property, too. Oh, and he a good trick, honey. And not too bad for an au fait. She paused and looked directly at him. You know him. You used to work for him. Freeman slipped his drink and looked at her, saying nothing. He's out here to step on the freedom fighters and the cat that started it all. Let's dance, baby. He moved to the amplifier and turned the volume up, then brought her to the center of the room, holding her close, his mouth close to her ear. If the room is bugged, they won't pick us up from here, not with the music, all right? He said, running on down. I figure you might know some of those cats and they'd want to know what's happening downtown. He held her a bit more tightly. He wondered if he would have to kill her. Had she guessed anything on her own, or had she been sent to him? What makes you think I might know any of the freedom fighters? Okay, maybe you don't, but you could get the word out. You know the city, and I don't. You're the only one I know here, and they need to know. Why are you sticking your neck out? She leaned away from him and gazed at him fiercely. I'm black, ain't I? He nodded and pulled her back into his arms. Who's this cat I'm supposed to have worked for? The general. You know who he is, and you know what he does. He thinks he pretty cool, but he talk more than he think. Course, he don't think I got enough brains to know what's going on. But a little piece here, little piece there, put it together, and you got something. She described the general. There was no doubt she knew him. Met him at this big place, some big brass from the Pentagon owned over on the Tidewater. They had a lot of chicks out. Every kind, every color. Them Pentagon cats pretty freakish. Everybody in D.C. know that. Great big pads, swimming pool, boat, place to shoot, and shotguns and shit everywhere. About a dozen whores and maybe five or six studs. The general was there and we spent all the time together. He dug my action and he got a big thing for dark meat. He a little bit freakish, but nothing really way out. He been my sponsor ever since, almost a year now. Well, baby, he really flipping out about these black freedom fighters. Thinks it's a communist scene. They want to find the au fait behind it and the head nigger and stomp on them. Ain't gonna be no arrest and trial if they get him. Yeah, baby, you worked for him. For a long time, I didn't think so. He talk about you all the time. You know, you, his nigger. First time he call your name, I think he talking about you, but the cat he talking about ain't nothing like I knew you. Then it start adding up. Must be the same cat. Chicago, same looks, live in the same place. I looked you up in the phone book after that time, the fuzz stopped us, and you lived out in Anacostia. But I didn't call you. Didn't think you dig that. But I just want to know where you live. Anyway, after a while, I knew it the same cat. You. And you got to be putting one of us on, and it got to be the general. If you come on like a Tom all that time, you got to have a reason. Never know you to do nothing without you know just what you want and why. So that's how I know how to find you and why I think you can hip the cats the general wants to waste. He had her describe the setup as best she could. He could fill in the gaps. It was a typical stakeout, a bit more elaborate than most. They had manpower, communications, weapons, and from her description of the few she had seen, some of their top agents. And they would have more money than anyone else in the game. They always had bread, and sometimes they got lazy because they had. But they wouldn't be lazy now. Hunting down niggers would be a new scene. Who's in charge? I don't know, she said. He ain't here yet. Coming in from overseas in a couple days. General says he's the best agent they got. Talk about him a lot. I try to find out. No, you better not see me again unless I get to Washington sometime. Maybe one of these days. He looked at her. Don't go square on me now. One thing you don't need is a whore. Even a ex-whore. They continued to dance and he questioned her through Sonny Stitt and a half of Ray Charles. Finally, he was satisfied and they returned to the couch and he freshened their drinks. She turned on the couch to look at him. I don't have to go home tonight. He reached out slowly and touched her hair. Baby, he said, ain't that kinky stuff pretty? Chapter 20. Oakland blew first, then Los Angeles, then leapfrogging the continent, Harlem and South Philadelphia. After years of crying conspiracy, the witch hunters found, to their horror, there was a conspiracy afoot among the black masses. Every city with a ghetto wondered if they might be next. The most powerful nation in history stood on the brink of panic and chaos. The freedom fighters fought first the police, then the National Guard, and finally the elite troops of the Army and Marines. Within a week, there were major guerrilla uprisings in 8 major cities in the United States, and efforts to eliminate them had proven futile. Several days of heavy rain, followed by a cool air mass moving down from Canada, broke the Chicago heat. The city lay under a bright, warm sun, and at night there was a cool breeze from the lake. The birds began their southern journey, and the leaves of the cottonwood, poplar, and maple trees began to change color, some of them reluctantly releasing from the limbs to trace a lazy descent to the ground to be gathered and burned at the curb and produce the pungent smell of autumn come to Chicago. At night, the city's silence would be broken by the explosion of grenades, the staccato message of automatic fire. The FF moved easily and silently through the ghetto, which offered them affection and support, their coloration finally protective. The curfew had silenced the streets below, and a cleansing breeze from the lake stirred through Freeman's apartment. Miles Davis, mute meeting Mike in a sexless kiss, blew bittersweet chocolate tones through the speakers. My Funny Valentine becoming a poignant poem of lonely love. Freeman and Joy sat on the couch, the lights low, the dishes in the sink, an empty wine bottle in the trash, slowly sipping their drinks, and Miles in the room, brooding, black and beautiful, saying his thing on his horn. In the sudden silence as the record changed, Freeman turned to Joy. Joy, he asked, what's bugging you tonight? Those damn freedom fighters, as they call themselves. You can't go to a cocktail party nowadays without running into someone who has lost his integrated job. My husband, she said with bitterness, has lost his staff appointment at the hospital, and he was the only Negro doctor in a white hospital in the city. What did he have to do with the riots? That's the point. Decent, innocent people are suffering. Now they want to get rid of me at the store. I can smell it. They can't let you go, baby. You're the best looking buyer with any department store in the loop. It's nothing to joke about. She took a long swallow of her drink. People are losing jobs they worked and sacrificed to get, all because of ignorant niggers who know nothing but hate.
Freeman rose to put another record on the changer, and John Coltrane's soprano sax gave an oriental flavor to My Favorite Things. Can't you remember, Joy, how it was to live like they do? Don't defend those hoodlums, those freedom fighters. She spat out the words in contempt. Are shooting real guns. Didn't figure to take long before some of them realized there's no win in throwing a brick at a man with a gun. Joy took a slow sip of her drink, watching him carefully over the rim of her glass. Dan, she asked quietly, are you mixed up in this?
Baby, you got to be kidding, he laughed. You think I'm stupid enough to get involved in a scene like that? They don't stand a chance.
You used to talk about this kind of thing when we were in East Lansing. You insisted when everything else failed, Negroes would have to fight.
Honey, he said reasonably, I was a kid in college then, and besides, everything else hasn't failed. We're both examples of the kind of progress Negroes have made in the last few years.
She searched his face for some clue, and he told her what she wanted to hear, calmed her, reassured her.
Look at all the Negroes we have in influential positions. A member of the presidential cabinet, a Supreme Court justice, a senator, and look at me.
He smiled. His arm swept his Playboy pad.
I've been poor, and believe me, this is better.
Honey, she smiled. I'm being silly. This thing has us all nervous and on edge. She rose gracefully and walked to the door leading to the bedroom. She turned and took off her wig.
Fix us some more drinks while I get comfortable.
And with a smile, she turned and walked into the bedroom. Freeman smiled with some relief. It had been close for a while, but he was sure he had convinced her. A short time later, lying bathed in sweat, her head on his shoulder, he was certain. It was hot the next afternoon, but the thick walls of the precinct police station made it cool and comfortable inside, and the desk sergeant sat oblivious to the station smells, working the crossword puzzle in the Chicago Tribune. The door opened, and a bit of the hot day outside followed a woman who seemed immune to the heat. She walked to the sergeant's desk, much like the models he had seen displaying fashions on television and in the newsreels. She wore a small white hat, white gloves, and a pale green summer suit of Shantung silk. The sergeant could not identify the material, but he knew it was expensive, so he spoke to her with far more respect than was usual for the colored woman who normally entered his domain.
Yes, lady. Can I help you? I want to speak with someone, she replied. About Uncle Tom.
That evening, Freeman, entering his lobby, found a coded message in his mailbox. It was from one of his double agents on the police force, indicating the police planned a shakedown of the block in which the FF had one of its arms caches. Because there was not much time, he ignored telephone security and, hurrying to his apartment, he phoned from his bedroom, the room lit only by the light in the hallway.
Daddy, Turk, listen carefully. The thugs are shaking down the block where we have a stash, Safe House 3. Move it right away to Safe House 6. Cancel tonight's hit if you have to, but get that stuff moved and check back with me.
He hung up, and light burst into the room. From the floor lamp in the corner, in one motion, Freeman whirled, dropped to the floor next to the bed, and reached for the pistol he kept beneath the pillow, but the gun was not there. "Freeze, Freebie," ordered Dawson. "Or should I call you Uncle Tom?" He sat in the Saarinen womb chair next to the teak floor lamp, his Service Smith & Wesson 38 police positive held with easy competence and resting on the right knee of his crossed legs. "The heat's not under the pillow. I have that one and the rest you had stashed here. You got quite an arsenal for a playboy. That how you get so much trim?" "Uncle Tom? Not me, baby. You trying to put me on?" And suddenly indignant, "What the hell you doing in my pad pointing a gun at me? I hope you got a search warrant, man." "Martial law, remember? I don't need a warrant." "Now you fuzz can continue to do what you always have in the ghetto. Only for a change, it's legal. That must take all the kicks out of it." Freeman, his eyes on those of Dawson, began to rise carefully. He had fired on the police range with Dawson. He knew what he could do with that revolver. "Like I said, freeze, Freebie." Dawson rose from his seat, the gun never wavering. "Okay, now stand up very slow and keep your hands where I can see them. Good. Now walk over to that wall. Hands as high as you can reach, flat against the wall. You know the drill. Now hold it and don't move." Freeman stood, his weight on his hands, flat against the wall and to either side of the Saito woodblock he had purchased in Tokyo. Dawson approached him, deftly searched him, then retreated slowly to the womb chair. "Okay. You can sit on the bed." Freeman walked slowly to the bed and seated himself as close to Dawson as he dared. "Man, you sure had my nose open, Freebie. Out of all the people in Chicago, I never figured Southside Playboy, nothing on your mind except chicks, clothes, good whiskey, and sports cars. A beautiful cover, now that I think about it. You think I'd risk all this for save it? I don't know if you are or if you're not Uncle Tom, and it's not my job to decide. I have enough evidence to take you in, and that's what I'm going to do." "What evidence?" "This reel of tape I found here. One of Uncle Tom's propaganda broadcasts you cats run all over the neighborhood from booby-trapped recorders." "I don't know anything about that." "You know, right up until I found this, I didn't believe it. Didn't even bother to bring my partner along. After I searched the place, I was going to wait for you and apologize for having to check out the lead." "That's mighty white of you. Who's the white man running things?" "How come there's got to be an au fait running things?" "You know, the Communist Party in the States is like any other white scene. A few showpiece spades in the name of integration, but whitey calling the shots." "And of course, a spade couldn't possibly have done this on his own." "Don't put me on," Dawson laughed. "The FBI detachment working on this thing say it's the most sophisticated underground in the Western Hemisphere, the creation of an expert." "And there sure ain't no spade experts, are there, Sergeant Dawson? Expertise is a white man's monopoly. They got a patent on it. You sure are brainwashed. Well, I got news for you. It's a spade scene. A spade scene. Dig?
You think because you've made a career out of kissing Whitey's ass, every black man is in the same bag? You're not going to bug me with name calling. You don't look so swinging on the wrong end of this gun. Makes you a big man, don't it? A gun, a badge, and a hunting license for niggers issued by Mr. Charlie. I found out a long time ago, big time, out there in those streets, that there are the people who get their heads whipped and the people who do the whipping, and it didn't take long to figure out which I was going to be. You're a fucking hypocrite. All that shit about helping your people. You want it both ways. To be super cop and have spades dig you too. Well, you can't be a cop without betraying your people. And you can't be with your people without betraying your badge. He hit Dawson in his soft spot, desperately hoping he could recruit him. And you think you're going to change the system, one man? There's no changing this system, not in our lifetime and maybe never. And the only way to make it is to get in the best spot you can find. I don't want to change this system. Just get it off my back. I'm no fucking integrationist. Integrate into what? Whitey's welcome to his chrome-plated shit pile. I dig being black, and the only thing I don't dig about being black is white folks messing with me. Who appointed you the savior of soul? What makes you more sensitive than anyone else? You think nobody else feels the way you do? You think there aren't days when I want to smash every white face I see? Or are you the only black man with a sense of outrage? Use your outrage. Hit back. Join us, Dawes. We got cats on the force, but nobody with your end. Join us. On the force? You don't stop at anything, do you? You've been using the Cobras. Them tracks in their arms got to be phony. How could you get kids involved in a thing like this? Who am I going to get involved? You? You're scared shitless you might miss a promotion, not qualify for a pension. We're a wasted generation, dehydrated by Whitey. I got to those kids before Whitey did. They're the only hope we have. How are things you're doing any better than Whitey? How are you any better? Why should I be? I'll do any damn thing to be free. Yeah, I'm Uncle Tom. There ain't a damn thing nonviolent about me. Anything Whitey can do to keep me on my ass, I can do double to be free. And when I'm gone, there are others to take my place. I've heard enough. Let's go. Sure, man. Cuff me. Freeman rose. Dawson still seated and held his hands forward for the handcuffs. Dawson reached for the cuffs in his back pocket, and as he did, the change of his weight in the foam rubber chair threw him off balance for a moment, and his gun barrel shifted. He saw it in Freeman's eyes even before he began the kick, and with the way of an athlete, Dawson compensated for his imbalance. Even as he moved further into the enveloping softness of the chair, he brought his gun up and fired without aiming. Freeman's kick sent Dawson over backward with the chair, the gun spinning away, but the shot had hit Freeman a glancing blow in the side, half spinning him. Noticing that Freeman had been hit, Dawson moved for the weapon on all fours, but Freeman, recovering, kicked him again in the side, sending the gun slithering across the room on the nylon carpeting. Dawson turned on his knees toward Freeman with his arms crossed in front of his face in a judo defense,
ready to block, parry, or grasp a flailing leg. Groggy, but still dangerous. Freeman faked a kick, and when Dawson covered, chopped him hard on the junction of the neck with the edge of his hand. Dawson fell to all fours, and another kick turned him over. Freeman, moving in, chopped him hard on either side of the neck, and grasping his collar with either hand, one crossed over the other, he applied pressure until the muscles of his arms ached from the strain. He released him and knew before he searched for a pulse that Dawson was dead. He squatted at the side of his dead companion, rocking back and forth on his heels.
Shit, Dawes. Shit. Why you, man? Why did it have to be you? Anybody else? Anybody?
Abruptly, he stood, and when he looked at the dead body of his friend, his face was impassive, except for one fleeting moment. He walked to the phone and dialed.
Daddy, this is Turk. You get that stuff moved? Good. Get out to my place right away. It's condition red. And bring one of the big mail sacks. I got something for you to move.
He walked to the bathroom and stripped to the waist to check the wound. It did not look good and was bleeding freely. He dusted it with sulfur powder, placed a gauze compress against it and a thick towel over that. Returning to the bedroom, he put on a loose sports shirt and a cardigan. He checked himself in the mirror, and there was no telltale bulge. He walked to the living room, and he put a stack of records on the stereo and mixed a stiff drink. Then he sat down in the dark room to await the arrival of his lieutenants. Dawson was too good a cop not to report where he was going or check in when he could. When they found his body, Freeman's cover would be blown, and probably that of the Cobras as well. The pain began to eat into him, and he thought that his cover might not matter anyway. A doctor would have to treat him, and there would be no first-class surgical facilities they could use if necessary. They would all have to go underground now. At least he wouldn't have to kill Joy to protect the cover. He called a doctor he had recruited and told him to come by a half hour before curfew. The doorbell rang, and he opened it to let in Daddy, Scott, Stud, and Pretty Willie. He motioned to the bedroom. In the bedroom. Take it out and dump it somewhere.
It's Dawson, said Dean.
They crowded around the body.
Not Dawson, said Stud. He's your main man. How could you kill Dawson? It would be like me killing Daddy.
And maybe one day you'll have to kill Daddy, or Daddy you.
Yeah, I killed him because he got in the way. Anybody who gets in the way has to go. Nobody counts until we're free.
Did you think we were playing games? Killing people we don't know and don't dig? 40% of those paratroopers out there are black. It's a badge of honor for a black man to wear those wings. They soldier and fight to earn what no man can earn. Freedom. Dawson's one dead black generation, and you might be another. But at least you won't be dying an inch at a time. No more of Whitey's con man's integration games. Freedom on the installment plan, interest collected daily. Freedom now. No more begging, pleading, and silent suffering. Don't tell me who I killed or what it cost to do it. If you can't pay the dues, then get out. He paused, gazing at Dawson's body. They watched him in silence. He looked up abruptly, searching their faces in turn. He nodded in satisfaction.
Condition red. All attack teams in the field nationwide. Hit them everywhere you can. Everywhere they're fat, smug, and complacent. use his strength and cockiness. Hit him, disappear, and hit him again. Hound, harass, fuck with his mind. Keep getting it up and don't back down. Willie, I want you to take over the DC operation as soon as you can get there. Here's a phone number in Washington. Call her, take her out, and buy her a drink for me. She drinks Johnny Walker Black Label. All right, move out. He motioned to the body. And take that with you. They stuffed Dawson's body in the mail sack and without a word left the apartment, their thoughts on the fighting ahead. They're not boys anymore, Freeman thought, staring at the door of the apartment. After they had left, they don't need me anymore. You grow up fast in the ghetto, and I helped them grow faster than most. I wonder how many of them will be alive or free this time next year. He poured himself a stiff drink and thought that the doctor wouldn't be of much help. Hours later, he sat in the darkened living room listening to the first of the shooting, the rapid crackle of automatic weapons, the spit of rifles, the explosion of grenades. The firing grew in intensity in counterpoint to the music Lady Day singing God Bless the Child. He sipped his drink and listened. Say it, baby, he said aloud. Sing it like it is. God bless the child that's got his own. Go on, you black-ass cobras. Go get your own. Freeman smiled, and the pain didn't matter anymore. In fact, for the first time in many years, he hardly hurt at all.
Context of White Supremacy. That is all she wrote for Sam Greenlee's The Spook Who Sat by the Door. If you have commentary you would like to share, the number to dial is 641-715-3640, and the code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. It is raining like biblical rain right now. We might need Noah. Like, super, super hard rain right now. Just getting that on the record as well. The number again, 641-715-3640, and the code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Again, we are all done. There is no second audio segment. This is all she wrote, so if you have observations, major takeaways from the book, themes, anything that has come up over the course of the past month, I guess, that we've been reading this, recurring themes that we've talked about, feel free, dial in. Let's get your thoughts out. Again, no second segment. We are all done. We will get to the phone lines. Two themes I guess I wanted to get responses or thoughts on. The first one, what do we make of the symmetry and the conclusion to The Spook Who Sat by the Door and Quentin Tarantino's Django Unchained, where both of these films that are essentially about counterviolence in response to white supremacy, both of these films climax with one black male killing another black male? That's one. Response, thoughts on that. The second, why do we think Dan Freeman, his pseudonym when they're doing their propaganda and giving their little radio speeches and what have you, why do we think his pseudonym is Uncle Tom? Significance of that. Folks have comments on those two thoughts and or your own observations. Feel free, dial in. Everyone who dialed in with a hand up, your line should be open. Feel free to contribute.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, greetings. Yes, greetings to the other callers. Nice conclusion to the book. Somewhat different than the movie in the end. But some of the things that stood out to me was when the National Guard was called in and they started losing to the freedom fighters, and the commander was humiliated, relieved of his duty. Then it said that the National Guard unit reacted with predictable ferocity to the humiliation of their commander. Never a well-disciplined unit. They now roam the streets with their weapons fully loaded, around in the chamber, and safeties off, eager for their first kill. It's, you know, almost a pattern that, like one of the soldiers was saying, that they were going to get even. It's in every instance where there were a revolt or some kind of action against the established white domination, then the consequences behind that were grossly overmatched. In other words, like when Nat Turner and his revolt, then the slaves were, heads were cut off and put on the tops of fence posts for miles, you know, to enact fear. And it's the same thing centuries ago when the Romans would put down a slave revolt. They would have the bodies along the roadside, you know, crucified. That same tactic, using fear and that viciousness, you know, that comes out of them when they feel threatened, is a definite pattern that we should pay attention to. And then what I liked about Freeman was that the strategies that he was using, the demoralization of the enemy, releasing the propaganda through the speakers and leaflets. You know, it's all expertly done, and it had them thinking that there had to be somebody else, because these, you know, poor ignorant Negroes couldn't possibly be coming up with these sophisticated strategies and this modern weaponry. I thought it was interesting the way when he started describing some of the battles, you know, and the gang members, he said that that after long months of training, they were eager for their baptism of fire. And then if you think about it, gang members, you know, would probably be used to violence. But then most of that violence and mistreatment would be towards other people of color. But then this would be another type conflict, violent conflict, and it was one of seriousness, and where all the other instances of violence would pale in comparison to what they were getting ready to encounter at that time. And I thought that Stud Davis was codified in the way that he carried himself. And then I like that interesting part about how he controlled his excitement like he did before an athletic contest, that drowsy feeling, and that he would gradually release it upon the first round fire. So they were anxious to get into the fight, and they had a purpose and a reason now for fighting. One part, though, got me was when I think it was Stu, and he encountered one of the white National Guardsmen that was apparently dying, and he was about his age. And then Stu looked him in the face and paused. Well, the boy asked him, why? And Stu bent down and told him, because it's war, Whitey. And then a lot of instances you have to ask yourself, if it was the same situation and it was in reverse, would the same thing happen? If that was Stu laying there asking why, I doubt if the white person, the National Guardsman, would even answer him with some hot lead, probably. And quickly, I'll get to Joy and the Dahomey Queen. you know, I was hung up on one part when Joy took off her wig right before they went into the bedroom. And then, as opposed to the Dahomey Queen, when she came to see him, her hair was natural, and she had very little makeup, no lipstick, you know, nothing. But he was more suspicious of the Dahomey Queen than he was of Joy. And then it turns out that, at least in my belief, the way I heard it, that Joy was the one that turned him in, was the woman that walked into the station. And by her being friends with Dawes, then Dawes was turned on to what was going on. But I'll mute my line, give somebody else a chance. Thanks for taking the call, Gus.
Good to hear from
you.
Yes, hello? Ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hello.
If you could hold on, sir, we'll hear from our female caller first.
I just wanted to answer one of the questions as far as Freeman using the name Uncle Tom, and it's basically because, of course, at the end, he had basically martyred himself, and he had attached himself to, I guess, what they were calling the gang members in the book, you know, hoodlums and everything, and he wasn't necessarily willing to give them up. But one of the main things that caught my eye was at the beginning of chapter 19 and how they portray, I think it was the colonel or the general, as Colonel Evans, how he escaped, how he got injured during his heroic escape from the hoodlum captors when really he was overtaken. And I thought that was definitely very powerful how, you know, of course, like Malcolm X said, you know, the media can make the innocent look guilty and the guilty look innocent. And it definitely, that definitely struck a chord with me. And then I just, kind of piggybacking on what the last caller said about how the Dahomey Queen, how she embraced her natural black self. And I felt like that was kind of like showing black self-respect and how she basically took his advice, took Freeman's advice in the earlier chapters about, you know, being more natural and the hoop earrings and the red dress and the less makeup. So that's actually what I had. Thank you, and I'll mute myself.
No, I appreciate that. In the movie, they make it distinct that Joy is the one who rats on Freeman. I think in the book it's a bit more subtle, but I think it's still Joy. I guess people can comment on that as well, if you think it's Joy or if you think it's someone other than Joy who goes to rat out Freeman. But other folks that we have not heard from who have commentary?
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Hello, how you doing today? I didn't quite catch the beginning of the conversation. Are you guys talking about the Birth of a Nation movie?
No, sir. We're talking about, this is the book club on Sam Greenlee's The Spook Who Sat by the Door. Perhaps you can just listen for a while and see what's happening in the discussion.
Okay, thanks.
Yes, sir. Other folks who had commentary?
Maybe.
Yes, ma'am. Go ahead.
Greetings, everybody. To answer the question as to why I think Dan Freeman took on the pseudonym or the pseudonym of Uncle Tom, is because I think we look at Uncle Tom and the caricature of Uncle Tom as though Uncle Tom was really Uncle Tom, and we don't necessarily deconstruct Uncle Tom. But what if Uncle Tom was really Dan Freeman? And the whole time, like, there's an Uncle Tom who's in white people's face, who's placating the white people. He's really gathering intelligence. He's really, you know, really for black people. He's not necessarily what we've come to think of him as solely someone who's up underneath whites. That's what white people think of him, because that's what he puts in their face, and that's what they feed back to us about him. But in fact, he's about black people, like, and he's willing to do, like, not only is he willing to do it, he's capable to do it. He's malleable, his personality or his face or his mask, he can do it and bear that burden so much that he can be around white people and learn about them and all that kind of stuff and bring it back to the people, all in the hopes that we can move us along and get us so that we can have freedom. I'm a little emotional, actually. I have the same feeling that I had when I watched Birth of a Nation at the end. Like, I knew it was happening. And I just got really, really sad when it did. And, well, he's a wonderful writer. But anyway, I think that's why, that we haven't taken the time to really deconstruct Uncle Tom, nor have we done it to Mammy. I think these are two stereotypes that are put in our faces. These people just really love white people, and I don't really believe that. I think that they were people who were just played their role and did the best that they can do in the times that they could do it. So I think that might be why I would just postulate or put that into the conversation, that perhaps he took that pseudonym to throw people off, to throw white people off, but also to give us a little more insight and to humanize Uncle Tom and not let us black people not make Uncle Tom and take Uncle Tom the way white people want us to take Uncle Tom, and to believe that there were these black people who were just all about white people and couldn't care anything about black people. I reject that thought. But that's just a possibility. To answer the other question about the two black men both dying in the novel and then in Django, I think it's just a really great way of saying there's a lot of death in The Price of Freedom. And on the, I don't want to say the good side or the bad side, like to qualify it like that, but on the side of freedom or the other side, like however, you know, excuse me if I'm not that articulate with it, but the price of freedom is death, and people die on both sides. That might just be why, and especially as black, as we, you know, we're always going to die. I know that seems kind of heavy. Seems really heavy, but we're always going to die until we get free. That's just kind of how I feel about it. But again, that's just my opinion and a thought. There was a couple of themes too that really, really stuck out to me as I listened to the story. The first is of sacrifice and of simultaneous humility. I've given the thought, or, you know, I've given this whole concept of humility, like, a lot of thought, like, what is this whole thing, you know? I think most people who act like they're humble aren't really humble, and this is like they use their humility as their badge or something like that, but it's, like, fake. So, you know, what is humility? And I think Dan Freeman, like, really kind of, his character defines it for me in a way, that humility is just, it's something much, much bigger than you, and you really just don't matter. When your goal is so big, when the goal is so in the future, and he's really honest, like he doesn't deny his reality at times. You know, he's like, well, I could totally do this. You know what I'm saying? I got the house, I got the women, I drink this great liquor, like I could do me. But it's much bigger than me. And I think just that constant reinforcing of that reality makes it, can help someone be more humble, or it is humility. I'm still not 100% sold on what the definition of humility is. But he seemed to be humble to me, even though he has a very strong personality and a very strong character, and also immense sacrifice. Like Dan Freeman gave his entire life to it, gave up the possibility of love, I'm sure he had it, but you know, like marriage and kids and a family and all that stuff, like gave it all away, devoted all his energy, all his time. And I think, you know, BGQ, I'll say that, and I'm not saying anything bad about where we are. We're doing the best that we can with what we got, and, you know, we'll just keep doing what we can. But I don't know how many of us are really that dedicated. Are really, like, would we be willing to do that? And perhaps that might be something for us to consider when we look at this fictional character. But he did it, you know, and it could go on. And so maybe if we all had that same kind of voracious desire for freedom, that kind of understanding, who knows what could happen, you know. But so that leads me into the second theme of middle class. Throughout the novel, the middle class is problematic for Freeman, and he just really does not rock with them, which I totally like understand, and I totally get it. But throughout, like towards the end, he's even able to recruit people from the middle class, which I was like, well, that's wonderful, because some, just to be also, I guess, transparent and honest, some might look at me and be like, I might be, you know what I'm saying? But I don't really feel like that. I would, hey, if it could go down, count me in, you know what I'm saying? I'm willing to, you know what I mean, use my role and position in whatever way. And so it was nice to see, like, you know, in his mind, he's like, I really don't rock with y'all. I don't trust you. I don't like you. But then he's able to find those there that, who cares about these stupid comforts? I'm ready. I want freedom just as much as you do. You know what I mean? So what, you know, anyway, not to get into it. I won't talk too long about it. But I did appreciate Mr. Greenlee putting that into the novel and allowing Dan Freeman to also grow in that way and to incorporate the middle class. And that when I was thinking about it, because I'm forgetting his friend, the police officer that he killed. I don't know what his quote unquote class would have been, but it also had me thinking that perhaps it's not the class that's the problem, but the desire for, like, to level up. I don't know the right way to say it, but to have more, and that hope to have more, that hope for integration, or that hope to be accepted and all that is what would, is the, whether no matter what quote unquote class they would be in, would be who you want to keep your eye on, the one who believes that having more or whatever would be that's the solution. So it's not necessarily those who are not in middle, you know, like whatever, in the ghettos, and the people that are in middle class. Like, it's not where we actually like are, but whether or not we're absolutely committed to having more, and we are more committed to having more than freedom. So I might have complicated that, but thought about it too much. But those are some of the things I have to say. If there's time, we can talk more. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes, ma'am. Glad I remembered to re-unmute you. I did want to also share, I know Pumpkin.
Thank you.
I know Pumpkin, she says frequently, has interjected that Uncle Tom, going all the way back to Harriet Beecher Stowe, who is another grand, well-meaning, not racist white woman, allegedly, in her book, Uncle Tom tries to help black people as best he can in a very weak position. I mean, there are other issues with his character, but generally he is trying to help other black people, that got distorted by racists along the way. But anywho, other folks who dialed in who have commentary, observations they would like to share, feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay. The book, the theme of the book has a lot of historical connections with it. Obviously, one of the historic connections that I had associated with it when I first read it is the Black Panthers, the organization, the discipline of, you know, having a group, you know, to fight against racism, white supremacy in its own way of militancy, and especially being this, during the height of the Black Power movement as well. Also, I see a connection with the Haitian Revolution, considering a lot of white people, a lot of white Frenchmen during that time was wondering, well, how in the world are slaves organizing in a military fashion? And they realized that some guy named Toussaint was training these guys militarily to fight the French. And to gain their freedom in Haiti, and probably one of the reasons why they're suffering in Haiti now, because obviously the system of racism, white supremacy, doesn't allow black people to fight against them militarily. So that's some of the major themes that I take away from the book. And in regards to your question, the first one being, what is the similarities between the killing Django at the end of the black guy and the killing Dan Freeman of his friend in the book. And then also the question of why did he use the Uncle Tom character as a propaganda piece. Well, it's interesting, and you were talking about the Harry Beecher Stowe novel, Uncle Tom. I actually find a connection with those two questions because the first question, you know, in regards to, you know, black on black violence, you know, kind of connects to the Uncle Tom character because if I can remember, Uncle Tom was beaten severely by Sambo. And it was, and I think he was killed by that sequential beating. But unfortunately, Uncle Tom forgave him for that, but, you know, but that's a connection I kind of see there with those two themes that you brought up. So, and I think that's about it. If I have anything else, I'll chime in later, and I'll mute my line.
Okay, I'm just double checking to see who caused Uncle Tom's demise in the novel. I was thinking it was Simon LeGreer, but I'll double check and let you know. Anywho, other folks who had commentary they would like to share, feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
All right. Greetings to you guys and to all of the callers and the listeners. I love this book, and reading it again is just very powerful, especially reading it with all of you, so I'm really happy to participate. Listening to the clip you played that introduced the show and listening to the grandsister, Sam Greenlee, and props to Dr. Kamau Kamban for coining that term. It was just incredible to hear his voice because the audio of the interview that my son had with him when he was 13 years old, we lost it due to a virus on the computer. And when I heard him talking, it reminded me of when I listened to it because my son, at one point in the interview, had asked him what he felt about the black acting that he saw at that time. My son's now 21. So when he was 13, it would have been in the early 2000s. And his exact words, and he actually said it in the clip, he said, "They hoes." And my son, like just split his side laughing when he said it in the interview. He just couldn't stop laughing because he had never heard an elder, you know, speak so candidly about what he felt. And a lot of what he said introducing the show in the clip you played introducing the show, he kind of reiterated to my son in that interview. So it was really great for me to hear it because it jogged my memory of listening to that audio, and it was just really beautiful. This week's book reading was really powerful. I've thought about to answer your question about Dan Freeman using the moniker of Uncle Tom for his propaganda campaign. I thought very similar to the black female that spoke earlier, that, and from my take, I take it that, to me, Uncle Tom has always gotten just, you know, a negative connotation because of the misunderstanding of his character. He was counter-racist to the best of his ability in the circumstances he was in. So, and that's, to me, was the epitome of United Independent. That was his way of countering, you know, white supremacy in the context of that text. And to me, Dan Freeman exemplified exactly what the sister said earlier, just the idea that I might look like I'm shucking and jiving for these white people and I'm doing what they want, or I might even enjoy whatever they are making me do. But, you know, I'm going to try in every way, shape, or form that I can to counter this system. And for Dan Freeman, what he did in the book was the best that he could. And just like for Uncle Tom, what he did in the context of the book was the best that he could. And then to answer the other question in regards to Dan Freeman killing Dawson and comparing it to Django killing the other black male at the end of the movie, I just kind of look at it as just reality. And especially for Dan Freeman, because it's funny, when I was like 16 years old, and this is when I was like really in the midst of doing a lot of negative things on the street and getting into trouble and just really doing stuff I had no business. I was too young, but that's just the life we lived then. And I remember when I first started to understand what black people were being subject to, and I remember the rage. I mean, it was such a palpable, visceral rage that I used to walk with, which facilitated a lot of the violence and negative things that I involved myself in at that time. And I used to actually have visions of like violent revolution that was very similar to this book. And it was long before I read the book. So when I read the book, it was I was endeared to just the concept of changing minds first. And then once the minds are changed and you have a critical mass of changed minds, you start to put things into action to facilitate what you have already come to understand through your life experience and through your research and your education to make you understand what is necessary at a given point in your seeking to transform the system of white supremacy into a system of justice. And in those circumstances, you might have to, you know, kill someone that you're close to. To juxtapose the fact that Joy was the person who actually facilitated Dawson and really put him onto what was going down. That whole idea that the person closest to you could be your biggest betrayer, just all of these things are realities we have to really take into account, because this kind of stuff is serious business. It's not, you know, it's not a joke. When you take in life, it's not a joke. When you even come to the realization that you have to take life, it's not easy. You know, even for some of the coldest killers, you know, their first kill is usually the one that they always say they remember, because it's just burned into your memory that you're taking literally the life of another living being, another sentient being, you know, that, you know, under ideal circumstances, you wouldn't and you shouldn't. But for whatever the reasons are in that moment, you feel that that is a necessary decision that you have to make. It's a lot to really think about, and it's a lot of weight to carry. So I think that those two scenes just kind of put that into your mind that, you know, there's, like the previous female caller said, there's going to be casualties on both sides, and specifically with Dan Freeman killing Dawson. To me, it's just, you know, sometimes you never know who it might be. It could be your sibling. That's against you, because there's going to be black people who take the side of white supremacy and bear arms for white supremacists and fight their own people. And sometimes those people might be people you're related to. So I just think he put that in the mind of not just the fact that you're taking a life, but the fact that it could be someone very close to you that you never would have thought it would have come to that, but it ends up coming to that. So I just think he tries to give a lot of food for thought. And that's how I would juxtapose those two to answer your question. To get to the text, I'm going to start the beginning of chapter 18, where Mr. Greenlee writes, the National Guard unit reacted with predictable ferocity to the humiliation of their commander. Never a well-disciplined unit, they now roam the streets with their weapons fully loaded, around in the chamber and the safeties off, eager for their first kill. The ghetto, with survival instinct centuries old, faded into their homes and guarded, and the guard, and the guard turned their fury on the very streets where the black mob had roamed only a short time before. All undamaged stores were used for target practice, a handful bombed with grenades under the assumption that they were colored owned. We're evening things up, said one sergeant. Trigger happy, panicky, smelling the hatred and contempt the ghetto Negroes felt for them. They fired at almost anything that moved, and black casualties mounted. What I found very interesting about that is that they're sending military units into an impoverished area. So these people have already had war waged on them economically and politically. So they're literally destitute. And then because of the drugging of their commander, they seek to what they call retribution is not really retribution. It's just further destruction of a demoralized and abused people in the first place. So it's like they abuse you to put you in that situation in the first place. When you try to defend yourself, physically speaking, then they abuse you even more by basically shooting at you on sight and destroying your businesses. And they call that payback for you just trying to get one leg up after, 500 years of tyranny. So this is the way, I love the way he formulated white psychology and psychopathology, because that's exactly how they think. And we have to understand that these are the types of creatures that we deal with on a daily basis, even though they may not display these sorts of behaviors for us in an overt way at all times. I like the section on page 226 when Stud had shot the white guy in the military, and as he was bleeding out, the boy asked over and over why, and Stud bent close so that the boy could hear, and he said, because it's war, Whitey. What I thought about that was, I thought it was really a great scene written in the way that they said that he might have played basketball against this person, so they were the same age, and again, he wasn't emotional. It wasn't about hatred. It was about it's war. He understood that white supremacy is war on black people. I am, basically a warrior in this war, and you are the enemy, and you just have to go because that's how war works. Just like when white supremacists kill our people, they don't care. They desecrate the bodies. They steal our organs. They do all of that stuff. So essentially, he's saying it's war. So there was no hatred there. It was calculated, scientific. He knew what he had to do. He did his job. And then, he actually paid the guy some courtesy by even answering him, because he didn't have to. He could have just put a bullet in his head and called it a day. So I just thought that was really good that he was able to be calculating and non-emotional as far as carrying hatred. It was just about getting the job done. The dialogue between Joy and Freeman in regards to when she was calling the revolutionaries those damn freedom fighters, I found that to be a very interesting dialogue, simply because it really makes you think about the fact that when something like this is to happen, when we come to a critical mass of non-white people who understand what's going on and want to do something about it, ultimately the retaliation is going to be on those other people that look like us who choose to work the 9-to-5 and stay out of trouble. The same way when Obama got voted into office, the racism, white supremacy practice on black people across the country just skyrocketed simply because we were getting the backlash on the ground level for the hatred of Obama from the ground level up to the highest levels of political office. And it's really good that he touched on that simply because that's something that you want to think about. But then at the same time, there were people who were working class, middle class people who also wanted to see the system end. And it also makes me think about the fact that for us to really get any real change, we're going to have to sacrifice things. And you might have to sacrifice that 9-to-5, that comfort, because the idea is that you're going to have to give up basically everything to start from scratch and build something anew that's better than what you had before. Otherwise, you're just going to have another variation of white supremacy anyway, which is not going to be a system of justice, and all of the injustice that we see will just go on in perpetuity. So ultimately, we're going to have to sacrifice a lot in order for us to make the change that we want to see. That's what I'll say for now. I was going to meet my line. Yeah, I'll chime in later if I get the opportunity.
For sure. Other folks who had commentary they wanted to share?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
All right. How are you guys doing? Everybody on the panel, on the line. Great conversation. I kind of feel out of place because I haven't read the book. I was actually watching your old video on Tim Lodge. I'm from Louisiana. I'm wondering how people don't see that. But that's another story. I was just listening to the caller, and he gave a very detailed and good summary on at least the part that he was speaking on. And as he was talking, I was wondering how can us as a people kind of get back to where they were back then? It seems like this is the conclusion I came to as I heard him talking. It seems as if we're going to have to be forced to make that sacrifice. We're holding up the system. And as long as we're holding up the system or working within the system, and we don't have the mindset of trying to break it down within, then the only way the system will fall is if we walk off from underneath the table. But the point to where he was making I think we have an identity crisis. I think blacks back then were very aware of, number one, military, science, and, they had a method of, they had a military mind. And number two, they had the ability to identify the enemy. And you made an excellent point when you said, hey, this is a war of whiteness. As if this wasn't war, as you said, they might have played basketball or something like that. We could have been friends yesterday, but today, this is war. It's nothing personal. This is, as today, war is a business. And you talked about, the National Guard and how they would come through and kind of destroy infrastructure, which is what I see going on in other countries, and gentrification here. There's so many similar. It's almost like they've been practicing since this event. It's almost like they've practiced and, it hasn't changed. The game plan, the main objective hasn't changed, but of course the plays in the playbook along the way change. So I think that's the evolution of oppressive behavior that we're seeing today. But I'm definitely going to dig into this book, and I just enjoyed the conversation and all the information I got from it. And I love you guys.
Are there other folks who had commentary on the book that we have not heard from?
Good evening, Gus, to the callers. I listened to an interview with Mr. Greenlee before, and he made it clear that the book is basically a fantasy. But playing the devil's advocate for a moment, if something like that were to happen in major cities, the easiest way to stop it would be to cut the water off, cut off food shipments, cut off energy so you'd be hot or cold all the time, and that would be the end of it. So to me, the most revolutionary thing that we can do in 2016 is to learn how to grow food, procure water, and controlling our own energy. And I think that it's hard for us to do that because we're so dependent now on this system and its comforts that it seems like there would be too much work to do such a thing to minimize your dependence on the greater society. So we try to say that, well, we want to get free. I think we're already free in a way, but we're afraid of the work that goes with being free. So, I mean, what it may take for maybe mass layoffs with these jobs and such, where we're forced to pool our resources and to buy land or...
You're not really talking about the book. I do want us to try to stay on topic as opposed to just, talking about anything. Did you have commentary related specifically to the book?
No.
Okay. Does anybody have commentary specifically related to the book? That sort of, if you want to share those sort of views, which are great, the compensatory call-in on Saturday, always great, where people can offer suggestions, that sort of thing. Definitely encourage and agree, looking at growing our own sources of food and being as quote-unquote independent as possible. I think that would be helpful. But do folks have commentary specifically on the book? Didn't miss anybody.
Can I be heard?
Oh, yes, ma'am.
I'll just say this. I forgot to mention one other theme that I noticed was strategy. He's extremely strategic and effective because he's strategic. I've been paying attention to, like, it's like sometimes when we talk about strategy, all of a sudden it's like we clam up or something and we don't go further into it. And when I say we, I just mean even other people outside of the Cows radio family, who it all of a sudden just becomes like, I don't even want to have the conversation anymore. Yeah, there's a problem. And it's like the minute that there's work or effort or something like that. And I'll tell like a quick little thing because the strategy is extremely important. I was listening to another show and I quoted something, a quote, I forget the quote now, but pretty much we really shouldn't be raising, you know, being out here rioting and stuff because it's not effective. It's escaping my mind right now. And someone else who's real prominent on like Twitter had mentioned that they say what they want to say and all that. And I retweeted it, not familiar with Twitter, all like that, but retweeting it just so the people in my circle. And I was like, but is this effective? And then he and I went back and forth a few times and I was like, well, is it strategic? And then he said, well, what is that? And then I snapshotted or screenshotted the definition of strategy. And then it turned into this whole thing about him being intellectual. And I was like, look, I'm not coming at you. I'm not saying anything like that. I'm simply saying the things that, like, if you have a lot of listeners, or if you have a lot of people following you, you're over there telling them, oh, how great it is to just say how you feel about racism all the time. And I feel like that's pretty much just telling white people that there are a lot of us who are frustrated, which means that they're just going to prepare more. Like, it's not strategic to be that vocal. If it was, Dan Freeman wouldn't have done it. He wouldn't have been as strategic and quiet and calculating as he was. Very calculating, even who he spoke to. So strategy is a theme that I think we definitely can take away from the book. It's one I definitely take away from the book. And at the same time, like being cool with my mask. That's another theme I guess I would talk about. I guess they might go together. We don't have to be the mask. So, you know, definitely doing something where we take it off, but definitely put it on. Because if we're at war, we can't be this vocal all the time. We can't be this expressive all the time. We can't wear our emotions on our sleeve. We can watch their glitchiness and their mask melt away, but ours has to be stone cold, just the same way that Dan Freeman's was in the book. And I definitely appreciate that. Because sometimes if you wear the mask too much, you either start to, like, even how he said, you know, I could totally give into this. You almost think you can. You didn't smile at people enough. They didn't smile at you. You start losing touch with reality a little bit. And then something happens, you know, maybe someone calls you a nigger or whatever. And next thing you know, you're reminded. But we can definitely be very conscious, aware of our mask as we put it on and off. And that's part of our strategy that will feed into our sacrifice. But thank you very much.
Did folks have any thoughts on Joy ratting him out, like that? What that signifies? I wasn't even thinking within the context of how much gender conflict the system creates, but just the significance of Joy ratting him out. Or and certainly, if anybody thinks that it was not Joy who went to the police station with a nice hat, dressed nicely, and getting more respect than a white person, white officer would normally give a colored woman. If anyone thinks that was not Joy, certainly you should, you know, speak up. But what do we make of Joy ratting him out to the police? And I guess I'll re-ask, since it seems like we do have people that saw The Birth of a Nation. And I think you could respond to this question even if you haven't seen that film, but just do we think there's a genuine similarity between the two films? Sam Greenlee, they have the documents that the film was harassed. It was not allowed to have a full theater run. They even have documentation that FBI agents were involved, COINTELPRO style, in getting the film to not play long stints in theaters. So people did not have access to seeing the film, and then it wasn't available in VHS format or anything for decades after its brief run in 1973. Do we think that's comparable to what happened with Nate Parker and his new project? Does anyone want to respond to those two questions specifically? What do we make of Joy ratting out Freeman and comparison between Nate Parker's project and Sam Greenlee's film?
Can I be heard? Oh, you go first. I'll go after you.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Just answering the first question, I definitely felt that it was an I definitely feel that it was Joy just because of who ratted out Freeman, just because of how they definitely described, just like what you were saying, of how she was dressed and also how, like, she walked. So it almost seemed as if she was one of those quote-unquote middle-class Negroes who kind of carried herself in a more sophisticated way, I guess you would say. I do feel like, and I actually noted that in the, I can't remember which page it was on, but how she was definitely very upset about her husband losing the job because they were starting to purge Negroes, even though he didn't have anything to do with the riot. They still kind of wanted to get as many Negroes out of their creature comforts or out of their high positions as possible because, of course, we're all expendable. And I not quite answering the second question, but I definitely felt like it kind of correlated with the house Negro, quote-unquote, in The Birth of a Nation, how he was saying in the film, well, you know what, you killed us all. He was saying that to Nat Turner, and I kind of feel like that was basically what Joy was saying to Freeman, or kind of hinting at that same sentiment. But that's all I had. I'll mute myself.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
All right, and can you just reiterate the first question for me?
Let's see. The first question, what do we make of Joy ratting out Freeman?
Okay. What I make of that is, I'm trying to think of the right way to say it. I think because in this day and age, and I would say it probably started a few decades ago, just studying the history of our experiences in the Western Hemisphere as black people, it was the black woman who literally is the reason that we exist right now. If it wasn't for her diligent work in trying to protect her offspring the best way she knew how, in a situation where she had no control over her daily reality at all, we wouldn't be here. And there's from what I'm seeing, just a wholesale assault on the black woman's psyche, as well as just killing her outright, as we've seen in recent years. And that assault on her psyche, I believe, started with the feminist movement. There's a lot of evidence and work out there that discusses the fact that Gloria Steinem worked for the CIA and facilitated using, I forget the black woman's name, to propagate feminism, which was done purposefully, and she was given millions of dollars to do this, to destroy the black family, which I think was highly successful. I think that's also what has led to a lot of the gender confusion amongst black women today as well, that we see, whether it's in the movies or just in life we walk around. And I think that ultimately, Joy represents to me the black woman who has been so psychologically assaulted by the system of white supremacy that her response to white supremacy is to ingratiate herself into it, get wherever she can get comfortable, and try to live the most productive life she could in whatever comfort zone she has that she has built for herself. And via that would make her an enemy to the struggle for freedom, simply because she has been convinced that the only system there will ever be is white supremacy, and her response is to get in where you fit in and try to make the best life possible. That's what I think in reference to her being the person who turned on him. It's not like she was a double agent working for the white man. I just think she was a black woman who wanted to try and live a decent, quiet life, you know, hopefully have a husband, have some children, and basically call it a day. And once she realized that in her mind, if Freeman did not convince her in some form or fashion that, you know, he wasn't involved, she just, you know, she said, well, in her mind, I'm pretty sure she felt like they were going to lose the war anyway, and that they were making it so hard because she was on the verge of losing her job. Her husband lost his job. And she wholeheartedly was blaming the people that were involved in the struggle for liberation. So in her mind, they were the enemy of what she was trying to build for herself. And that's why she did what she had to do. What was the second question?
Similarities between this book film and Nate Parker's Birth of a Nation in terms of the releases of the film and them allegedly being sabotaged while they were in theaters.
Oh yeah, it's beyond a similarity. I think that The Spook Who Sat by the Door is the precursor, and it's just the first chapter in a legacy of that. Anytime a person, whether it's historically so-called inaccurate or not, I mean, some of these movies that they put out, 300 and these other movies, they're not historically accurate either. So for those people who want to just chime in with the, oh, it's not historically accurate, no movie is going to be totally historically accurate. And the closest thing you'll get to accuracy would be a documentary, and that's not what he set out to do. And also, I'm sure he wanted to make the movie in some form of fashion entertaining as well. I mean, it is, you know, entertainment, so that's a part of it, in my opinion. So ultimately, I believe that whenever you have, because what I've said this before, I don't know if I said it on this program, but I've said it before, that when white people saw hieroglyphics and they started to learn about the way the human mind functions, they realized that our ancestors actually knew that the human brain thinks in pictures, which is why they used hieroglyphics for that very reason. Dr. Richard King, in his book, The African Origin of Biological Psychiatry, outlines that beautifully. And when they realized that, they started to make moving hieroglyphics that were racist, and they called it cinema and movies. And they know that that's the most powerful medium to get into the human psyche and get as deep into the psyche as possible. And when you have a film that is counter-racist, that is showing counter-racist violence, that is showing black people displaying the utmost forms of black self-respect, they're not going to have that being shown to the masses of black people anywhere on the planet possible. It's not going to happen. And once that is recognized, they're going to go after it exactly how they went after Nate Parker. This situation with Nate Parker happened decades ago, and they waited, literally, like you say, they will hold on to something about you and wait till your moment, and then bang, it'll come out of nowhere. It never came out in any other time in his career, but the moment he made a counter-racist film about the ultimate nightmare for America, which is what Nat Turner was. Remember, he led the largest resurrection in the Western Hemisphere. Revolution in the Western Hemisphere. So he terrifies white people. That's why they burnt him. That's why they chopped him up. That's why they made leather purses and wallets out of him. That's why they ate him. It was because he terrified them. And that...
Hang tight. I just wanted to double check to make sure we didn't miss anybody.
Sure.
Appreciate it, Roz. Any of the other folks that are on, did you all want to respond to those questions? Joy, writing him out, comparison to Nate Parker and the films, both projects allegedly being sabotaged when they went to theaters. Other folks want to respond to either of those?
Can I be heard?
Right on.
I'll be super quick. I actually was, at first when I heard you read the story the first time, I thought it was Joy. But then when I gave it a little bit more thought, and sometimes I have to like think a little bit more to make sure I'm being like a little clear-headed, I actually really could see it being the Dahomey Queen. And here's why. I won't say that she made it into money, but she kind of leveled up, like she came up a little bit. And the guy that she used to work for is her quote-unquote sponsor. And he's the one, you know, providing her this lifestyle. She's been putting money away and all this stuff. Just because they said she had nice dresses too. She wasn't in like rags or anything anymore.
She was living well. She had her own place. She had her own thing going on. And she's the one who would really, really know. Like, I don't recall in the story, and I could be incorrect, Dan having that feeling at the end, like, yeah, I got this in the bag. She, you know, he was very open, as far as I know, and, you know, receiving information, and even the way that he pulled her into the middle of the floor and they danced. With Joy, on the other hand, you know, he was like, that's my old thing. And, you know, she threw off her wig and they did whatever they did. And he knew that night or that morning or whatever, nah, this is good. Like, she's not tripping about me. Her mind is off something else, and who knows? So, I mean, I don't know. Of course I don't. But I think it's quite possible that it could be the Dahomey Queen, just because she pretty much just came up. Just like, I don't think it's about where you actually, like I was saying a little earlier, it might not necessarily be where you are, but the hope of having something might actually be stronger. See, Joy had already been there for a while. You know, she could also be a little disillusioned with it. And her husband lost a job. Like, I don't think, you know, that, I mean, it's possible, but I also think that it's quite possible that it's the Dahomey Queen as well. I don't know really how to say exactly why, but something in me says it's quite possible that it could be her. It was also his friend that he thought he could turn. That was the one that was about to kill him. Maybe that's another thing. Like, you know, everybody has a mask and, like a two-face. And so, you know, she walked away pretty, and you know, she's from the streets. Like, she knows how to play as well, you know? And so it could have easily have been her. And it's clear that it's not like white people or some people respond all the time more appropriately to lighter skinned or anything like that. Like, she has the colonel who's sponsoring her entire life. She has very nice clothes. She could have went in there and was like, you know, I know it's you. That's why I showed up. I came to tell you a little bit of things, but I just leveled up and I like this, the way that this is. It's really not so bad. Like, since she's new to it, she could easily, I could see her giving into it. Versus someone who's been in it and is like, well, it is what it is. I just miss, you know, you. And I remember you talked about it, but I mean, look at you. Like, why would you even do that now? You have everything and could have anyone. So it's quite, I think it's actually quite possible it could be the Dahomey Queen. Thanks.
Yeah, made that clear.
Was there anybody else that was going to respond to either of those questions?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I have something also. I believe that, like the last caller said, it could possibly have been the Dahomey Queen, because the book leaves it to your imagination. And then if we are in a system of white supremacy, it would be nothing to use either one of those female companion, Freeman, to actually turn on him. And one thing that, speaking of strategies, one thing that Freeman didn't practice himself early when he was talking to the gang members, and they said that it was some females in a certain gang, he said, oh yes, they can be used also. He had in mind that a female member could infiltrate and do things that a male could not do. But then when it came to his female companion, it didn't seem throughout the book that he suspected either one of them, and that could have been actually his downfall. And like you say, the usual suspect, white supremacist. Because if you think the FBI can't get to somebody, one, and put them in between a squeeze, and have them to do anything that they want done. And the CIA was involved in this particular case. And then, guess what? Those people taught Freeman. So don't think they didn't know what was going on and how to bring him down. And I see a lot of similarity between that film, the new film coming out where they're attacking Nate Parker. Is there any time there's, like someone said earlier, any work towards counter racism, you're going to get that racist interference, and it could come in any form. That's why when you're on a stage like that, you have to try to keep yourself beyond reproach, and that's hard to do in a system of white supremacy. So I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Appreciate that, Mr. Demery Ford. Anybody else want to respond to those two questions? Right on. We will have additional time if you have any other comments related to the text. Concluding thoughts. Again, we are all done. Done with Sam Greenlee's The Spook Who Sat by the Door. Any differences between, major differences between the film and the book that folks want to point out, you can feel free to get that in as well. Again, in the movie, they show Joy snitching to Dawson. So they leave no ambiguity. I guess I would say, and even before I get to all that, number one, I checked Simon Legree, the racist enslaver. He orders that Uncle Tom be killed, and the overseers, they comply. Now, I just checked this online briefly. It did not specify whether the overseers were white or non-white. Regardless, whatever happened, they were ordered to do this by Simon Legree. So, in my view, Uncle Tom was killed by a racist man in the novel. That notwithstanding, I think with the book, like, let me go to my notes. That way I can kind of start fresh from the beginning. I forgot I had not read everything that I wrote down. Okay. When it says he was, this is, I guess, on 229, bottom of 229, it says Freeman, he was extremely careful in attempting to recruit anyone from the black middle class. I think some of you all touched on that before. But then later on, we heard today that he recruited black doctors, he had black enforcement officers. I'm not sure if he gives like a crisp, explicit definition of black middle class, but I would think if you're a doctor, that's, you know, got to be in the ballpark. Just to me, it shows that, you know, regardless of who that non-white person, victim of racism, specifically we're talking about black people, that if they get accurate information about racism, white supremacy, they can and oftentimes will begin to make logical counter-racist decisions. Not saying you should expect it, but I think anybody, regardless of, you know, how many nickels racists have allowed them to have, people get accurate information frequently. They do accurate, correct things. I was saying about Joy and the Dahomey Queen. He does threaten to kill both of them, or at least he says that he has already thought about this, and he is prepared to do this on 233. He talks about wondering if he would need to kill the Dahomey Queen. Seems like he has a high level of suspicion and, you know, do what he needs to do. And then he talks later on about being thankful that he doesn't have to kill Joy. So he certainly seems to have a high level of suspicion of both. I was just going to say with the Dahomey Queen, because she was linked to the whites at the CIA, I think if she had snitched, it would not have just been Dawson. I think it would have been like a whole phalanx, and it would have not just been local enforcement officials, because she was so connected to much, much more powerful racists. It would have been, you know, like CIA, FBI, and, you know, it would have been a whole SWAT team. I think, and certainly, it, at least for me, having seen the movie, it certainly is, you know, influencing. I'm probably biased very much because in the movie they just show her snitching. But just going by the logic in the book, because it's just the local police, that would lead me a little bit more to it being Joy. Just because if she goes to the local police and then Dawson says, oh, okay, I know this guy, I'll check it out. That seems more logical than if the Dahomey Queen snitched, which she totally could. But the main point, Freeman was prepared to kill both of them anyway. Moving forward, I thought it reminded me of the senator in South Carolina who had sexual intercourse with a very young black female, teenage, Strom Thurmond. very young black female, produced a child with her when the Dahomey Queen, when she says that now she has a quote-unquote sponsor. This would all be a cowbell. And she says, the Pentagon cats are pretty freakish. Many illustrations of that, of these white folks in a position of power. Donald Sterling, Anthony Weiner, you could just go on and on and on. The judge who was taking photographs and having sexual intercourse, probably with a lot of black males in exchange for reducing their sentences, lots of illustrations of that. I thought the exchange where Joy was fussing about, you know, her husband having lost his job and all because of these ignorant niggers, just that anti-blackness. A lot of times we end up blaming other victims of racism and how they are responding to white terrorism. I think that happens so frequently where whites, they don't get blamed. Somehow it ends up being the culpability is isolated just to other victims and how they choose to respond. And the pattern where whites, racists, they punish indiscriminately. Any black person will do. Yeah, for any sort of perceived wrong, we go out and kill and fire or do whatever we need to do to large numbers of non-white people. The whole exchange between Dawson and Freeman, I thought, was pretty revealing for many reasons. Dawson's insistence that there has to be a white person in charge. The use of the word spades, that's something that I've been pointing out for a few weeks. It seems to be, at least in my view, particular disdain for black people when the term spades is used. I think Dawson, here in this exchange where he says a few showpiece spades in the name of integration when he's talking about the Communist Party, which seems an accurate understanding of racism to me. And then Freeman responds, and of course a spade couldn't possibly have done this on his own, kind of being sarcastic. And then he says, and there sure are no spade experts. Just to me, it seems like it's particularly calling out the anti-blackness of all of this, that, you know, blacks cannot be intelligent, blacks cannot be experts, blacks cannot organize anything sophisticated to challenge whites, and just invoking the term spades to really call attention to that. Do folks here know what au fait means? Just checking.
Yes, it means a white person. It's an old school term, though, but it means a white person. Au fait is one of those terms that we use for white people.
Right on. It was in Malcolm X, Pig Latin for foe, which I always thought was showing quite a bit of counter-racist logic. It's foe in Pig Latin, right, au fait?
Mr. Charlie, too, another term for that.
Right.
That he used in the book, yeah.
The portion where he's name called, I thought Dawson was pretty codified, where he has his gun on Freeman, and Freeman is calling him all sorts of names. And Dawson says, you're not going to get me with any of that name calling. I'm a lot more codified than that. Very important, even though, you know, he's not exactly doing the counter-racist thing in general. I thought it was pretty interesting as well, the portion where he says, this is Dawson speaking. He says, and you think you're going to change the system? One man? There's no changing this system, not in our lifetime, and maybe never. And the only way to make it is to get in the best spot you can find. I don't want to change the system just to get it off my back. I think that is the way that so many victims of racism think, that there's nothing that can be done about racism. This problem cannot be solved, and so we just want to get the best possible spot possible. And just chill out. And, you know, if I can, you know, eliminate some of my personal problems, that's great. I'm not interested in crusading. I'm not interested in joining any of you black organizations or none of that. I just want to eliminate my little personal problems and move on with my life as best I can. I think that is the exact position that the system of racism will encourage the vast majority of victims of racism to take. It just sounded very similar to a lot of things I've heard victims of racism when they've spoken with me in real life. Even comments where Dawson, where he says, how could you get kids involved in a thing like this, where he's talking about the Cobras. I was thinking, not only is that the exact thing that was being said to Dr. King in the 1960s. How could you get children involved when they're out marching in the streets in Birmingham, and the March on Washington, and SNCC having these very, very young black children, even in my mind, the Little Rock Nine, having these very young children out on the forefront, being beaten and jailed and everything else that was happening to them. And even the same thing I was thinking with Gus T. Renegade, where folks said, how could you have, you know, this 10-year-old on a program talking about justice? Same thing that I've heard consistently, and, you know, I just give the same rationale that Freeman gives in the book. I mean, hey, in fact, I will read what he says. He says, who am I going to get involved? You're scared shitless, and you might miss a promotion, not qualify for a pension. We're a wasted generation, dehydrated by Whitey. I thought that was such an amazing metaphor. Dehydrated by Whitey reminded me of Flint as well. I got to those kids before Whitey did. They're the only hope we have. Really powerful commentary, in my opinion. And racists, they do not avoid non-white children. They target, terrorize, kill non-white children as well. So, let's see, some of the other things I thought were important. Dehydrated. Already got in. Oh, yeah, I already mentioned that he recruited a doctor. And I thought it was really important as well. This would be the last thing. I helped them grow faster than most, talking about the children and the Cobras. I wonder how many of them will be alive or free this time next year. I remember vividly, I think last week or the week before, when he was talking to Pretty Willie, and he was talking about how he did not enjoy any of this. He did not have, you know, any great enthusiasm for this work. And I thought him both killing Dawson and thinking about, you know, these young black children that he's bonded with all this time, training them and getting to know them and hanging out together and learning and seeing them become enthusiastic about learning. And then knowing just the reality that some of them are going to die, some of them are going to jail. That's what's going to happen. This is war. And just being very honest about that, realistic. That's one thing I did want to make sure I got in, which is it just gave me great appreciation for Mr. Puller's codification. I think, and he has it in Maximum Emergency, I think there must be, in Counterviolence, there must be explicit dedication, and I mean like serious commitment to not killing black people. I thought about that weeks ago, like when we started this book, the similarity of this work, like Django Unchained, climaxing with a black male killing another black male in two films that are both ostensibly about counterviolence against racism. And certainly people have BGQ, but just in my opinion, I think the system leads to that frequently. That just that concept, that is the response that we should have, that all of this is leading up to me killing another victim of racism in my frustration or whatever it is that I'm trying to do, harming, killing another black person in particular. And I think that's something that we should really work to resist. I brought it out this summer when they had the shooting that was attributed to Gavin Long and Micah Johnson, in saying that black people died in both of these instances. We should really make sure, if we're going to commit counterviolence, that, hey, no harm is happening to other non-white people, other black people. And I think that is so important, because whites, they are so skilled at being able to present, to use, to manipulate other non-white people, and to just consistently, as it states in the book, showcase other non-white people, other victims of racism, so we get frustrated at them and we end up targeting and committing violence against them. And I think it's so easy, particularly what I've seen about Ken Thompson over the last week since his death, week and a half, 2 weeks, Ken Thompson, Marilyn Mosby, that it very easily can end up becoming, I am justified in attacking Ken Thompson. He's blocking our way to freedom. You know, these are dues that's got to be paid. Somebody's got to go. It's going to be casualties. So, you know, we got to deal with Ken Thompson. We got to deal with Marilyn Mosby. And just, it's so easy to end up on that list. I know that was something that I pointed out as a problem with Django Unchained. And that's something that I would point out as being, I would say a problem, at least for me in this text. It does not climax with the killing of Colonel Evans. They don't even kill Colonel Evans in the book. In fact, major difference between the film. We pointed that out last week, but they don't even kill Colonel Evans in the book. The lingering big battle to the death is with another black male. He didn't even kill the karate instructor from way back. I find that to be very consistent. I find that to be troubling and consistent, because I've heard even on this program, sometimes we are encouraged to have a real zest, a real enthusiasm about, you know, we got to deal with these Toms, and that's what we're going to have to do. We're going to have to get rid of them before we can get to, you know, dealing with crackers. I feel like I hear that sort of thing all the time. Am I talking nutty? Did folks want to respond?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I agree with you. I think that is very important to think about. I used to be of that mindset as well. You know, if you were a black person and you didn't really think about racism, white supremacy the way I did, as far as just how viscerally I react to it, as far as just it just makes me like ill, so I just have to do something about it most times. I think I used to have that same mentality. And it was actually the black female from Louisiana. I talked about her before. She made the documentary. You interviewed her. Do you remember her name? Oh my goodness, it's on the tip of my tongue.
Antoinette Harrell?
No. The one who made the documentary. That
Kimberly
was,
Rivers Roberts?
Her, Kimberly Rivers Roberts. And I remember when she had told her story, and she talked about just her background really coming from, you know, just an impoverished background. She sold drugs. She dealt with guns. So she would, like I said, she would be somebody that the average person would think is very disposable due to her background. But yet, when she got an understanding of white supremacy, she said, let me grab this camera and go do something. And she made, you know, a critically acclaimed documentary. And not only that, but it also sparked in her counter-racism and being interested in trying to change things. And, you know, that for me really solidified the whole idea that no one is really disposable. And there's always, you know, like you were saying earlier, you can reach a doctor. There's doctors who don't like medical experimentation on black people who are black. And if they understood how these things function, they would do something about it. Even though they have, let's say, $100,000, $150,000 salary, that doesn't matter. When they see injustice, they're going to want to do something about it. And I agree with you. Most times when people are presented with, you know, the truth, they're going to react in a way that's proper to respond to that injustice in some form or fashion. It kind of reminds me of Adelaide Sanford. She was the former Board of Regents for New York State. And she talked about talking to guys who were locked up in Rikers, black males who were like in their 20s and in their 30s. And she had asked them, you know, why they didn't speak to other young black males and other black females about not joining gangs. And they said they didn't because a lot of them didn't know how to read and write. And they were embarrassed with the fact that they couldn't read or write. So that helped facilitate their self-destructive behavior. And as she started to give them counter-racist information and information about how them being in jail is a setup, she said that you can palpably feel the shift in the room because these men had never heard anyone talk to them like that and expose them to that sort of truth. So everything you said is totally accurate. Thank you.
I was going to add it. It tends to be a long-running theme, even in Juice, Boys in the Hood, quite a few epic films, modern-day hieroglyphics. That's the major confrontation. It is not black person confronting white person. It's black person confronting and killing another black person, often childhood friends, which was the case in Spook Who Sat by the Door, which I just... Anti-blackness, Luke Cage, another one. That's the major battle. Black person, another black person, often family members. Other folks want to respond to that? Am I talking bonkers? Or if you had anything else you wanted to make sure you got in?
Yes, I was going to say that I agree with what you said. And I think that it is the jealousy for the affection or the validation of the white person that is
causing the, I call it a form of alternate reality in black people. You know, somehow they have this feeling that if they're against something that a white person is against, then somehow they'll be accepted until one day they get the wake-up call. And they see that they actually wasn't looking at things correctly in the first place. And I wanted to bring up some words that the author was using. Like you pointed out, Spade, and he used Oriental, had an Oriental flavor. I can't remember where in the book it was, but that phrase is no longer politically correct. And I believe one of the representatives, Asian American representatives, introduced a bill for that particular wording to be omitted out of all federal documents. President Obama signed that into effect, I think, in May of this year. But he had a phrase about when Dawson and Freeman were talking, and Freeman said sarcastically, "That's mighty white of you." These types of phrases was commonly used, but they should not be used. And, you know, we should look into phrases that do not accurately reflect, you know, like Gus always says, what you're trying to actually say. You know, just stick to that. And then there was one other one. I can't find it now, but the kinky hair, and how the kinky hair was so pretty. He was talking about one of his female visitors. The word kinky should probably be avoided from being used, because these phrases that whites have come up with, descriptions of our features and attributes, are not, you know, favorable to us, and we should not be using those phrases. I'll mute my line.
What was the difference? Yeah, yes, ma'am. I just wanted to ask Mr. Demery really quick. What was the difference you noted between the book and the film? I think you pointed out before.
In the end, one of the differences, well, one that stood out, Shorty was killed in the film, you know, but in the book, it didn't say that Shorty, one black person was killed during the riot, young kid, but they didn't say it was Shorty. And then Freeman was shot, Dawson shot Freeman, and it looked like Freeman just died there. But in the book, it was a glancing shot. And then he was actually waiting on a physician to show up, you know, which he could have died waiting. We don't know, but those are similarities. Those were not similarities. You know, they were different from the film.
Right on. The female caller that was going to speak, go ahead.
Yes, I thought that it was definitely one of the things that stuck out with me was on page 230 at the top, where it says he thought that if the Ku Klux Klan could infiltrate the Chicago police force, then there would be no reason the Cobras couldn't as well. And I just thought that was so unique, because just how, like, it seems like it keeps coming out as far as, like, on the news or whenever a black person, like on CNN, whatever, is trying to really drive home the argument as far as implicit bias, quote unquote, they always bring up the fact of how in 2006, the CIA found that
the Ku Klux Klan infiltrated the police force, and I thought that that was definitely something how he said that back in, the 70s, and they found it in actually in actual real life in 2006. The other thing I wanted to mention was how Dawson, being a victim of racism, white supremacy himself, how he had mentioned, well, you either get whooped on or you can do the one, you can be the one doing the whipping, which is, I know, like what we've talked about before, it's like just people taking such pessimistic choices, or it's taking those stances on how to either try to deal with racism, white supremacy, and not actually try to resolve it. Thank you, and I'll mute myself.
Appreciate that. Our retired firefighter, did you have commentary, sir?
Greetings, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I just got off from the high school game and came in. You guys were already finished with the, I guess, the last reading part. What I do remember, and I think this has something to do with what question that you brought up, where you talk about the final confrontation between Freeman and the other black enforcement official who was kind of like getting on to what was going on.
Right, we were talking about that.
Okay, yeah. It was years ago that I read the book, so I don't remember exactly how they went down in the book. But, you know, you see the movie all the time, and they kind of like in the movie, they kind of like fixed it to where it seemed like Freeman actually, it was kind of like self-defense in a way. In other words, the guy finally got wise to exactly what he was doing and what was going on, and was going to confiscate him, so to speak. And it ended in a violent confrontation. Was that similar in the book? Because I forgot how it went in the book.
Yes, it was pretty much the same.
Okay. But anyway, to go on to what I think you were asking opinions about, you know, the global system of racism, white supremacy have emotionally damaged us to the standpoint that we are, most of us are very weak in how we define ourselves. And it's our emotions is right, it's like right on the top, as opposed to some level of discipline that we should have, and we're kind of weak. So any old thing, I mean, we know if a white person says something, we're not going to like it. But inevitably, you know, for the most of us, know the power that they have, and I have seen that we don't really retaliate to them for the most part as what we would do to one another. And in a confrontation or relationship between two non-white black people who have that similarity, as I mentioned, that very weak defining of themselves, you're gonna have a very quick and devastating, probably life-ending confrontation. That happens a lot everywhere around the world very quickly. I mean, devastating. And it's something that I would say that the white supremacists fully know. That's the kind of reaction that their codified system does to people. I mean, it's logical. It makes logical sense, you know, in a devastatingly terroristic way. Hopefully I'm making sense on what I'm saying. But I've learned it a lot from the young people that I deal with, and I tell them directly, That, in other words, it goes back to how I said on how I'm able to communicate with them about justice and codification without necessarily talking about white supremacy. You know, define yourself. You know, define yourself not in weak terms, meaning that somebody only thing somebody got to do is say something, and automatically you go to physical violence mode. That's too weak. You got to be stronger than that. And they can comprehend that, you know. And so that's basically what my thoughts on that. Thanks for listening.
Appreciate that. Yeah, just folks have anything else they want to get in before we wrap up? Just reiterating, great book. I think he has great analysis, particularly in the context of when this book was published. I especially appreciated in the audio clip that we started the program with, and him talking about, because that was a more recent interview, right? So he was talking about the technology that's available, that you can shoot, you can do a film for a lot less in terms of money than what would have been required earlier. So, you know, if you have an idea, if you have a thought, just go and do it. Just talking about, you know, what an exhilarating experience it was, even though it was difficult and not knowing if they were going to make payroll and all the other challenges that they had not being allowed to shoot in Chicago in a movie that's supposed to be about Chicago, and just, you know, finding a way to doing it and just embracing that, hey, we are not mainstream. We are going to do this guerrilla style filming. I thought that was really really important commentary from Mr. Greenlee. But just even still, with the climax, and I have not seen The Birth of a Nation, but from what I've been told, you do not see like piles of white bodies. You see all kinds of gruesome things happen to enslaved black people, but you do not see lots and lots of brutality heaped on whites in a real gory manner. That's not the case. And I see at least a similar pattern here with this presentation, particularly as I said, you know, the general doesn't even die. Colonel Evans, rather, doesn't even die in the book. It's the big death, the big lethal confrontation is Freeman and Dawson, childhood black friends. And I think that's a consistent pattern. And even from that time period, that was very prevalent. And it's whites that win every time. I don't think you're going to be able to point to one single incident where, in our aim to end racism, white supremacy, and whatever the justifications are, that, you know, it's sometimes it's going to be a black person that's in your way, and we got to do whatever we got to do to get to quote-unquote freedom, to get to liberation. If that involves harming other black people, that's what we're trying to stop to begin with. And I just don't think you're going to be able to point to a single instance where us, whatever formula we were using, whatever strategy we had, where it involved harming, killing other black people, where that ended up putting us in a better position. I would challenge anyone to pick out such a scenario, because I don't think you're going to be able to find one. But this line of thinking is encouraged frequently. And I'll just keep going back to it. That's how you end up with people, you know, mocking Ken Thompson hours after he's died. That's how you end up with that sort of thinking, that sort of behavior. It's encouraged all the time. Our problem is other black people, and we just need to go upside their head. I will hush. Any final comments folks need to get in for Spook Who Sat by the Door, or are we satisfied?
I have one final thing I wanted to say concerning the cast of the movie. Well, Paula Kelly was a dancer and actress at the time. She played the Homie Queen. And she had a positive, I guess, pro-black role. And I was listening to an interview that Mr. Greenlee was giving on YouTube, and she didn't get any significant roles after that, and neither did the guy that played Freeman. I think his name was Lawrence. I can't remember his name right now, but he didn't get any big roles either. So the just doing the film affected the black actors and the retaliation, and that was taken out on them by being blacklisted. That guy who played Dawson, he went on to get other roles because, of course, you know, he was playing the role that the whites were closely identified with, but his career was saved. And I'll mute my line on that.
Lawrence Cook is the actor who played Dan Freeman. Lawrence Cook, that's his name. And Mr. Brindley did say that he struggled to get roles after playing Dan Freeman for this film. Is there somebody else who's going to comment?
Yes, yes. I don't necessarily, I'm not trying to compare black people, but the person who played Freeman reminds me a lot. He has a statue of Sam Cooke. He reminds me a lot of the way he sounds. Yeah, I think he did a very good job in the movie himself. And it's one of the times where the book and the movie, to me, goes down in the files of being two good sources of study, the book and the movie itself, which doesn't happen a whole lot. That's all I need want to say. Thank you.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I must say I agree with what you just said, Firefighter in Florida. I really compare because, I mean, to me, that's like really the epitome of forming like Voltron. What happened to the guy who played Dan Freeman in the film? It reminds me of what's happening with Haiti. I mean, you can't even act like you want to liberate yourself or the rest of your career is going to be trash because it's going to basically destroy your career. And it's just like, you know, with Haitian people, you know, how dare you, you know, kick out the white people who were dominating you. And then on top of that, you have a Pan-African stance where you offer freedom to other black people that were being oppressed to come to your country. Okay, well, we're going to just, you know, wreck everything in perpetuity for you. And that's what, to me, is just his actual career is the epitome of what white supremacy looks like. Thank you.
Anything else folks need to get in? Thanks for that, Roz. Anything else folks need to get in? Everyone satisfied? Grand. Oh, go ahead, sir.
I was wondering if you remember Mr. Greenlee mentioning anything about Jesse Jackson didn't want him to do the movie. And that his, I guess he had something to do with a lot of other black investors not contributing when he was trying to make a deal.
I did see an interview where he said something to that effect that Jesse Jackson, I guess, was not a fan of the film or him personally or whatever it was and didn't invest and I guess, attempted to discourage other potential investors from contributing to the film. And, you know, Mr. Greenlee has spoken repeatedly about how he doesn't care for Jesse Jackson.
Great,
thanks. Mm-hmm. Anything else? Folks satisfied? I will assume folks are good. We should be starting Lothrop Stoddard's The Rising Tide of Color Against White World Supremacy. Dr. Welsing was encouraging everyone to read this book. At the end of 2015, she was saying, read this book, read this book, read this book. I thought it would be great to read it right as the election is around the corner. But that's what we should be starting next week. I will not be reading it, thank goodness. This book is old enough. It came out in the early 20th century that you can download it for free online. I can post the link. It's on archive.org. You can get a PDF. You can get the ebook format. They have lots of different versions of it, so you can download it for free. I even suspect if you're at some place where they have a good library, they will probably have it in stock. It's very popular. But that's what we'll be starting next Friday. More of a scholarly read. It's a little older, kind of a stuffy white dude, but Dr. Welsing really wanted us to read this. I think this would be a great way, demonstrate some black self-respect, and I know she encouraged reading more than watching television, so I think she would appreciate us taking the time to study in detail Lothrop Stoddard's work. Anybody who wants to do some extra credit, Mr. Stoddard also wrote about the Haitian Revolution. I think it's called something, he used the term Saint-Domingue, the term that whites used prior to liberation and all that. But if you check his biography, it will show some of the other texts that he wrote, and you'll see the one that he wrote about the Haitian Revolution. I have read that one. It's pretty interesting. And his outlook and letting the Negroes run wild down there, run the good whites from France off the island. It is pretty interesting if you want to do some extra Stoddard reading. With that, we'll be here tomorrow. Compensatory call-in, 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. Central, 6 p.m. Pacific. And we'll be here on Sunday. Charles Woods, he talks quite a bit. He is a black cinema historian. We will certainly look forward to getting his thoughts on the comparison between Birth of a Nation and Sam Greenlee's The Spook Who Sat by the Door, and other aspects of white supremacy in film, television, movies. But that'll be Sunday, normal time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. If you have questions, guest suggestions, if you have problems, if you're trying to find something in the archives, if you have a gripe, complaint, feel free, drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com, untiljustice@gmail.com. Listener-supported counter-racist radio. Check the blog racism-notes.blogspot.com, racism-notes.blogspot.com. The PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you are not into PayPal, drop us an email. We will get you a physical mailing address. Huge thanks to all the folks who have invested, supported, closing in on 8 years delivering counter-racist programming. I hope the broadcast has been, continues to be worthy of your time and energy. With that, as I state consistently, sobriety would be best in conditions, under conditions of racism, white supremacy. I think it would be in our best interest to make sure that we are capable of making phenomenal decisions at all time to keep ourselves as safe as possible, particularly if you're going to be in a vehicle. You do not want to be under the influence, cigarettes, alcohol, whatever it is. You do not want to be under the influence and then have that be the time that you bump into Daniel Holtzclaw, Darren Wilson, any other race soldier, badge or no. Let's take it seriously. Let's make sure that our behavior consistently reflects that war is being waged against us at all times and in all areas of people activity. Sobriety would be best. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Yeah. I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.